possibly have a negative effect on the Minnesota student survey and in the testimony, and that it would stop the ability to have a survey. This would not stop surveys. It would just make sure that the parents were aware that they were going to occur and have the opportunity to opt their children in if they wanted them to participate. This process could be as easy as when you sign up with your immunization records and et cetera at the beginning of the school year. You could opt into the surveys that were being contemplated. And then individual teachers, if they choose to ask these type of questions for specific assignments, of course, they would then either have to have those available at the beginning of the year or seek that permission from their students throughout the course of the year. That's a pretty straightforward bill, and the rationale for that is that these are the kind of issues that many parents don't feel belong in the school environment, are not integral to learning, and that should not be addressed or included in the curriculum without parental involvement.
All right, are there any questions or comments? Representative Dorn.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I don't know if this is for Representative Holberg to answer or if someone from the department. Someone had raised the question to me, really, of whether or not and it's on the student survey, and I realize the bill is not just that. Whether or not the information that was gathered by the student survey was used at all in terms of any federal dollars that would come in for programs. I don't know if you've heard this question or not, Representative Holberg, but I just thought we should raise it. If there is a fiscal question, we should know about that.
Representative Holberg.
Mr. Chair and Madam Chair and Representative Dorn, we did hear testimony and policy from people opposed to the bill that they did use this data in order to receive grants. But again, this bill would not stop the survey. The survey would still continue. The results of that survey would still be used as a basis for applying for grants. There should be no fiscal note associated with it because it would not prohibit the survey and or its results being used for an element of a grant application.
And Madam Chair, and we did hear it in policy, and not to dwell on, I think one of the questions that I heard was that it is theoretically possible for the survey to continue, but when you do the opt-in, whether or not you get a true sampling or something that has validity under that scenario, some of the folks I talked to felt that it just wouldn't be used because they couldn't pull it off in terms of having validity. So, and that's a point worth debating, but there was some question as to whether or not it would still work. But I don't know the connection with the grants. And no one from the department has talked to me about that in specific terms. And so there is a concern.
And Madam Chair, if I might, District 194 does have an opt-in policy. At the beginning of the year, we get one sheet of paper. It asks three questions. My best recollection of the three questions is your child allowed to leave the school building to go to adjoining property for field trips such as going to take water out of the wetland for science, etc. The second being, is your child's picture or image allowed to be used in publications that the school district does? And the third being, do you want your child to participate in surveys? Mm-hmm. And the vast majority of the parents sign yes, 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 and hand the piece of paper back in, and it's like no big deal. Mm-hmm.
Representative Dorn?
No, thank you, Madam Chair. Those were concerns that I heard subsequent to the policy committee, and if there's follow-up, I think people will talk to us or share the follow-up if we need to know more.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I share the concerns of Representative Dorn, and for me, it's not the parents who show up and fill out the forms. It's the ones who don't, and there might be students who want to take the test, but their parents haven't filled out those forms, and that may not be such a problem in a district like yours, but in some districts, it's a huge problem, even getting parents to come for conferences and to come up, show up for any all-school things, and so I think this is a huge opportunity lost for information that we could have on what is going on in our schools so that all parents know what kind of environment kids are going to school in, as well as information for the state on how we might best spend our money. And I'm very concerned that we would get a very select population in a lot of areas with this measure.
Are there any further questions? If not, House File 1551 will be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Thank you, Representative Holberg. Would you please go on to your House File 1948?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, and members of the committee. The 1948 is a bill that would limit the type of activity that could be conducted in the schools relative to campaigning. We spent quite a bit of time with this one as well in policy and civil law, and I have also worked with the School Board Association and made some changes. But basically what the bill does is that it would allow, it would require school districts to set up a policy to regulate behavior and, in fact, prohibit behavior by school employees to pass or defeat ballot questions, to elect or defeat candidates on the ballot, and to pass or defeat provisions at the legislature. It does, of course, allow for individuals on their own time to advocate for or against particular candidates, but as official representatives of the school district and or on company time, it would prohibit such activity. And the second part of the bill addresses the school districts need to provide timely factual information about pending ballot questions. We've tightened up that language a little bit, but it was to begin to address some of the situations where fund balances were discovered days after an election was held, et cetera.
Are there any questions on this one? Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Chair Sikora. Representative Holberg, as you were putting together your language for this bill and putting your ideas into this bill draft and ultimately a bill, did you find that some of what is stipulated in here is part of the bargaining in a school district? For example, the use of email. Have you found out whether or not that is something that is bargained?
Representative Holberg.
Madam Chair and Representative Erickson, I haven't researched the contract specifics of any particular school district in the state, but I can tell you in policy there was discussion from the Education Minnesota that they thought this should be a local issue and negotiated on a per-district basis. I don't know if that relates to union negotiations or not, but what I do know is relative to a lawsuit that was filed. Education Minnesota sued District 194 Lakeville Area Schools in order to be able to distribute Gary campaign literature in the teachers' mailboxes, and as part of the information around that lawsuit, it was stated that in a number, if not every other district in the state, they had the opportunity to distribute campaign material in the schools and were in fact able to work it out with other districts. And so I don't know what the term work it out means, but whether it was, again, a part of an official negotiation as a part of a contract or rather a more informal agreement.
I'm sure. Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Chair Sikora. Just a follow-up. So, Representative Holberg, if this becomes law, would it override local policy?
Representative Holberg.
Madam Chairwoman and Representative Erickson, yes, it would. It would mandate that each district have such policy, irregardless of what their current policy is now.
Representative Grannan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Holberg, how are we now with the school board superintendents? Maybe Mr. Kite is waiting to tell us, and teachers' unions.
Mr. Kite will be testifying later. Representative Holberg.
Madam Chair and Representative Greiling, I don't know if you want to hear it from their mouths exactly, but I know that the School Board Association has been appreciative of a number of changes that I've made to the bill for clarifying purposes. I don't know whether they have an active position as far as supporting it, but I don't think they're opposed to it, as I discussed with them after the civil law hearing, and we adopted a number of changes. The position of the Education of Minnesota is stated in their testimony, in two occasions, what is their preference, that this not be a statewide policy, but rather that it be negotiated on a district-by-district basis.
Representative Holberg, I have on occasion received lots of emails from computers that were in schools, lots of phone calls from school lines. Would that kind of thing all be prohibited by this bill?
Madam Chair, it kind of depends on the nature of the contact, but I found in that not every employee of District 194 would conform to the standards as strictly as others. But what I found happen, at least in Lakeville school districts, is for the most part I now receive emails that provide information on the issues and don't tell me how I should vote, if you will. And then one thing that's really, and I have three different school districts in my particular house district, so I see a wide range of contacts. One of the things that this would most definitely prohibit is that many of us have received what I refer to as the canned emails, or rather the same verbiage comes through from a number of constituents, and it's been likely put out by some type of advocacy group on a particular issue, and the constituent this then forwards that with their name on it to us. That would definitely be prohibited, in that we're regulating the behavior of the employee. And while the Save the Whales group may send the email in to the employee for them to forward that information, advocating for or against a particular position is definitely in violation of this type of policy. Contact that advocacy group and give them an alternative email to use if, in fact, they did want to be involved in a political process. So it's kind of a mixed bag. I think it's a good thing, and that I get lots of information, but nobody's telling me how I should vote one way or another.
Do you know, Representative Holberg, do other states have a similar statute?
Madam Chair, if I might, I'm hoping that I still have a copy. There was handouts provided at the policy meeting, but the Center for the American Experiment did a whole study of this particular issue, and unfortunately I don't have my copy of the document, but it is available online, in which they delineated this issue in various states across the country, and there are a number, more than a handful of states, I don't have the exact number, that do have similar policies and, in fact, more stringent policies.
All right.
And Madam Chair, if I might, just the reason for this is that all taxpayers pay for these resources, pay for the times of their teachers and school employees, and as we well know, the political will of that constituency, i.e. the taxpayers of a particular school district, covers a wide range on every single issue. So in one day you may be in agreement with the prevailing position coming out of a particular group of employees, another day you may not. And to just take the whole politics out of the school realm, my testifier in policy said that when she had a dinner party, there's two things that she doesn't discuss, one being religion, the other is politics. Religion is out of the school. We need to get politics out of the school as well.
All right, seeing no more questions. This bill, and I'm sorry, the one before it also, are not before us. These were sent to the floor, am I correct? We just brought them back for an informational hearing so you'd know what had become of them since we passed them out of policy and sent them to civil law. So I apologize. Both these bills are not in our possession, so will not be laid over. Thank you, Representative Holberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Committee.
And Mr. Kite, did you wish to testify? I know that Representative Holberg would like to get back to her committee, but if you can stay if you like.
Well, Representative Sikora and members of the committee, I'm not sure if it's even appropriate to testify here if it's not before this committee, but I would like to just say quickly that we listened to the testimony a couple of weeks ago in the Education Policy Committee from the Lakeville folks, And it seemed to me, just listening to that, that there were folks that were clearly out of line in terms of their behavior down there, in terms of interfering with an election. But at the same time, as we look at this bill, we're very concerned from the standpoint of the school superintendents. And I hope I introduced myself. Charlie Kite, and I represent the MASA, which is the school superintendents. There's two things in here that seem particularly difficult for us. The one is where there's language that says it prohibits you from either passing or defeating pending legislation. And I watch and you see lines of superintendents coming up here asking you to either pass or defeat legislation. Often in this committee, it has to do with transfers of funds from one fund to another, or something to do with funding a problem with school buses or whatever. But it's nevertheless, they are here promoting passage of legislation. This bill, as we read it, would prohibit that from happening. The second piece where it's difficult is where it addresses passing or defeating a ballot question. When a school board makes a decision to either, let's just use the example of a building facility, and they're asking the community to build a building, the superintendent, as part of their job, is really charged in going out into the community and explaining why there is a need. And while the superintendent works real hard to keep that information factual, sometimes is it factual or not is going to be in the ears of the beholder if they decide that it's a good idea or not. Superintendents are often asked in those various meetings of chambers of commerce, rotary clubs, etc., and even on the church steps, why do we need this? And then as you try to explain why you need this particular issue, you get caught in being right on the edge of violating this particular piece of legislation. So we're opposed to it and we're concerned about it, even though we're sympathetic to the other problems that are trying to be addressed. Thank you.
Mr. Kite, briefly, how would you fix it? It isn't in our place here today to fix it. How would you fix it? If you agree that there's an issue that needs to be addressed, but you don't like the way it's addressed, how would you fix it?
Madam Chair, I don't have the exact answer to that, but I think the bill is designed to limit staff from weighing in on elections that happen in communities, possibly changing the language so that it's clear that the persons that are assigned by the school board and charged by the school board to make these particular cases for or against would be allowed to speak or be exempted from this language.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Representative Erickson, did you have a question for Mr. Kite? Sorry. You don't get away that easily.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Kite, when superintendents or other school officers come before us, I as a legislator look to them to give information. I don't ask them to please tell the committee to support. I do that because I'm the elected official. So I oppose or support legislation. Usually if we carry something, you know, for example, for a school district, we're in support of it. So, you know, I think that we can learn a lesson from this. They bring us the facts, the information. We do the yaying or the naying, and that gets them off the hook. In the other respect, superintendents, you know, maybe we'll have to build into this some kind of partial immunity, because I know of what you speak, because in a recent ballot question, we had, during Sunday school hour at our church, the superintendent and others come in and explain the question that was going to be on the ballot, and it was informational only. But, of course, there were parishioners who felt it was, you know, the superintendent was out of place because maybe this was her position on the ballot question. And, you know, maybe, you know, we'll work with Representative Holberg on something to that effect. Because school superintendents, I know, get in precarious positions. But on the other issue, I don't think they have to come here supporting or asking for our support when we can do that for them, or the others who are not in their position can do that.
Representative Erickson, just trying to give a short answer here in interest of your time. Let's just take the case of your superintendent or your school district wanting to have a certain piece of legislation for that particular school district. That superintendent is going to use some of the resources of the school to come down here and, first of all, meet with you to help to craft the legislation. And then once that legislation is heard, you're going to ask that superintendent or that business official of the school district to come down and testify why that legislation is needed. And that, it seems to us, puts that right in the into the problem of being in the position of passing or defeating pending legislation, even if they're speaking factually.
Representative, go ahead, Bernardi.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I understand what Mr. Kite's saying. I mean, just the practicality of it. I have an employee here from my school district today testifying on behalf of Representative Sikora's bill. So, I mean, this is definitely something we don't want to stop. We need this information from people. So I just had to make that comment.
Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Representative Holberg.
If the fact of the superintendent wants to go beyond factual information and advocating one way or another, first of all, we have Attorney General's opinion that limits what they can do relative to ballot questions. That's pretty clear, and that they are confined to factual information and not advocating one way or another. The second point is that this does not stop school board members on their own time and their own resources from doing it, but I'm sure that, Representative Bernardi, I don't know what the case is with your employee from your district being here, but
the community ed director.
Okay, but if this employee is on the school's time, there's probably a certain percentage of the taxpayers that are supporting her salary at this point that are in disagreement with the position she may or may take. If she comes down and gives factual information, not telling us which way to vote, that particular segment of the taxpayers in your district would probably be a lot happier.
Representative Bernardi, follow up.
Oh, thank you. I just, Madam Chair and Representative Holberg, I didn't want to put this employee on the spot. So sorry, Ms. Johnson. She was invited by the chair to come in support of her bill. So, I mean, just the practice down here is not reflective of your bill. And oftentimes we use what's customary and that we do in the legislature. So I want to be able to use our people as resources to help us get bills passed, because that's what we're here for, is to help our schools and our students, and to quiet them, I don't think, is really the democratic way.
And Madam Chair, if I might,
Representative Holberg,
we're just quieting them on the taxpayers' dime.
Representative Demmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Holberg and members. I think, too, the distinction should be made here between somebody being asked by maybe one of us to come and lend factual information to something we're trying to accomplish. Contrast that with campaigns. I think maybe that's, Representative Holberg, I'm going to put words in your mouth, but I think us inviting a superintendent, a teacher, a community director, whatever it is, to come up and testify for information for us to make decisions about is quite one thing. It's quite another thing to be actively out campaigning on school time, using school or government resources to try to defeat or promote something on your own. I think maybe that's the distinction we're looking for, which could be gray in the middle, but I would submit, Representative Holberg, that would be a distinction maybe in terms of what you're trying to accomplish versus what we need for information here.
Madam Chair,
Representative
I would
Holberg.
Agree with that characterization.
Representative Klinzing.
Yes.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As an example of this line of discussion, I have a series of emails here that I would like to have distributed to the committee. I requested the observations from a school counselor who had some thoughts on House File 1551, so she asked in lieu of her testimony that I distribute an email on her behalf. And I'm sorry I didn't get here when 1551 is under discussion, but I do have some thoughts here from a school counselor I represent who would like the committee to know her views.
Those can still be passed out, Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Erickson.
Just one closing thought, Chair Sikora. This is really a good lesson for us to understand the difference between fact and opinion. You know, it's something that I know as an English teacher, I worked hard to distinguish the difference, and so we can, exemplify it here.
Representative Dorn.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I, you know, the more I look at it, I do have still some concerns, especially on what advocating for passing or defeating would mean, because information sharing, as Mr. Kite said, can get pretty close to the line. The other area, and the bill doesn't address it. I know in our district we've got a quite specific policy in terms of the mailboxes and how they can be used and by whom for sharing information among teachers, whether or not I have some say over what can go in, what I can have in my mailbox or put in another one, whether I'm relaying information or whatever, as a teacher. But there are also other folks who have limited access to those mailboxes who are not district employees, but are you know, certainly certain companies have informational brochures. Then a lot of people want to put things in school mailboxes, and some of them can gain access to put out maybe a retirement insurance plan or a long-term care plan or those sorts of things. So that it is a gray area in terms of how much people want their mailbox to be accessible and how much not. And that's why we have, a pretty strong local policy in that area. I don't know if all of that would be affected or not, but if we're talking about taxpayers and what their resources are used for, there probably are other cases that go beyond just political actions and employees, too, that we would be, we're probably ignoring, but someone will probably say we're not being fair, with that one, too. Oh, you better come.
Madam Chair and Representative Dorn, District 194 does have two additional policies that go hand-in-hand with this that regulate the distribution of materials by school employees within the schools and also from those outside the school community, if you will. And those are very strictly adhered to, and all materials have to have an okay either at a building principal level and or school board level, depending on the nature of the information.
Mm-hmm.
I don't believe we have any further questions, Representative Holberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. So we are moving on back to our original schedule here, Representative Klinzing. House File 1852. Representative Klinzing, would you like to move your bill before the committee?
Yeah, I'd like to move House File 1852 to be considered before the committee and laid over for possible inclusion in the education finance bill. What this bill is about is it's a very short bill, the blank appropriation, in hopes that we can get some money to Minnesota Humanities Commission, which has done a lot over the last 2 years to help teachers to get the content knowledge and some of the teaching strategies that they would need to implement the new content standards that were put into place in 2003 and 2004. With that, I'm going to have Stanley Romanstein talk a little bit about what that training entails. And we also have a teacher and a principal here today who are going to talk about the benefits of it.
Mr. Romanstein, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. members of the committee, good afternoon. I'm Stanley Romanstein. I'm president of the Minnesota Humanities Commission. The Minnesota Humanities Commission is the only agency charged by the state of Minnesota with providing content-centered professional development, the what of teaching, for Minnesota's teachers on the wide range of humanities subjects, history, literature, ethics, religion, geography, languages, social studies, and civics. The humanities form the very core of what we ask our children to spend their formative years, grades K through 12, studying and learning and exploring. But how does our work, how do Minnesota's kids benefit from our work in providing content-centered professional development to their teachers? The research is quite clear. Highly qualified teachers are the key to strong schools and to high student achievement. And what do we mean by highly qualified teachers? In his 2002 Secretary's Annual Report on the State of Teacher Quality, former United States Secretary of Education Rod Page offered a compelling definition. Quote, as Congress made clear through its definition of highly qualified teachers, and as the scientific research supports, the only measurable teacher attributes that relate directly to improved student achievement are high verbal ability and solid content knowledge. That is to say, if the teacher has mastered the subject that he or she has been asked to teach, and if he or she has the verbal ability to communicate that subject matter effectively and efficiently, students can and will learn, they can and will succeed. The new education standards enacted by the legislature in 2003 and 2004 demand that teachers be masters of content, lots and lots of content. Minnesota's K-3 standards in world history, for example, require that, quote, students will demonstrate knowledge of the historical development of at least three civilizations in Africa, the Americas, Asia, or Europe, close quote. In response, the Humanities Commission offers Minnesota's teachers professional development seminars on the geography and culture of East and South Africa, the Maya through an anthropological lens, and A Nation Divided, Argentina and the Search for National Identity. Our state's K-3 standards also require that, quote, students will understand the importance of key founding documents of the United States. The Humanities Commission offers a seminar on the Constitution and Bill of Rights and hosts an annual Bill of Rights Day seminar. Bear in mind that the vast majority of teachers in grades K through 3 were elementary education majors. They were trained as generalists, not as specialists in geography or history or social studies. Minnesota's history standards, world history standards for grades 9 through 12, require that students will demonstrate knowledge of Islamic civilization from about the year 600 through the year 1000. The Minnesota Humanities Commission offers Minnesota's teachers a 5-part series on Islam and Islamic civilization, as well as a seminar on teaching world religions in history and social studies classrooms. You have in your packet a list of seminars that the Minnesota Humanities Commission has offered over the past 5 years. The topics came from teachers themselves, and they relate to our state standards. We act in response to what our staff hears from teachers about real-life needs in the classroom. If you want to create stronger schools across Minnesota, if you want to see improved performance on the part of our children, ensuring that teachers have the content-centered professional development that they need, the kind offered by the Minnesota Humanities Commission, is among the wisest investments you can make. House File 1852 refers to an appropriation in blank. To determine the right number, one has to ask, how urgent are the state's education standards? And what impact does the legislature want to have on education in Minnesota? We would recommend that the legislature charge the Minnesota Humanities Commission with reaching every teacher in Minnesota over a 4-year period. We can provide meaningful content-centered professional development to 25% of our state's teachers every year for a state investment of $2.5 million. That number, $2.5 million, represents 61% of a public-private partnership between the state, teachers and their school districts, and the private sector. And in your packet, there are a number of charts that list different proposals. In the event that our goal of reaching every teacher over a 4-year period is unattainable, we've also included in your packets proposals that would allow us to reach 20%, 15%, and 10% of Minnesota's teachers each year. The annual investment on the state's part decreases along with the impact on classroom teaching, but the public-private partnership remains intact. I would urge you to vote in support of House File 1852. As you look to the future of education in Minnesota, I would hope that you would regard the Minnesota Humanities Commission as a valuable asset developed by and for the state of Minnesota over more than a quarter of a century. We make a difference, a positive, demonstrable difference in the way teachers teach and in the way Minnesota's kids learn and perform in the classroom. The word humanities may be largely unfamiliar, but it's what we ask kids to do during the 12 most important years of their lives, to study English, history, civics, social studies, geography, in short, to immerse themselves in the humanities. Our new state education standards say that we want our kids to have more of the humanities and to learn them well, because the future of our state and the future of our knowledge economy depends upon it. Thank you.
Other questions? Mr. Romanstein. Oh, we have other testifiers. Yeah.
Madam Chair and Committee, hello, my name is Peggy Anderson. I would like to thank you for the opportunity to speak with your committee today about the Minnesota Humanities Commission. I grew up on the east side of St. Paul, not far from the current facilities of the Humanities Commission. I've long been familiar with the building and its location near Phelan Lake. As I grew up in the area, I spent time swimming at Phelan Lake, skating at the rink, and even volunteering as a candy striper at the current Humanities Center building when it was Gillette's Children's Hospital. More than 5 years ago, I attended my first teacher institute. It was great making connections with a familiar place, but even better was the opportunity to make new connections with other teachers and to participate in quality, content-rich staff development learning. Since that time, I have attended more than 6 teacher institutes at the Humanities Commission. I've been with the Minneapolis Public Schools since 1976, and I am currently a teacher at Michael Dowling School in South Minneapolis. Like the former Gillette Hospital, Dowling was built to educate and serve handicapped children. We are now a K-5 Minneapolis Public School serving a diverse student body of 400 students, both regular education and students with special needs. Dowling has many teachers who have attended the Teacher Institute and is currently working with the Humanities Commission as a core knowledge school. As you can see, I'm an enthusiastic supporter of the Humanities Commission. My message to you today is, teachers need the Humanities Commission. Students need the Humanities Commission. As a teacher, I have attended many workshops and training sessions. Much of this training has focused on the process and strategies of teaching. What sets the Humanities Commission apart is the content learning opportunities for teachers. No other place have I had the opportunity to explore topics such as the Dakota conflict and Minnesota immigrants, Lewis and Clark, Europe and the Euro, or learned about the Minnesota history on the site of the Lower Sioux Agency. Teachers need the Humanities Commission. Before coming here today, I asked my students why they thought teachers and adults would need to go to classes and continue learning. One student said, because if you run out of things to teach, then we won't learn anything. Another student said, so kids can be as smart as adults.
Oh.
Yes. We want kids to be smart as adults, but unfortunately, adults don't always know as much as they should in many content areas. The result is that kids are only as smart as the teachers that are teaching them. Only when we challenge our own learning can we produce curious, smart kids ready to learn and ask questions. I thank you for your time.
Good afternoon. My name is Latanya Washington, and I'm the school director at Wise Charter School in Minneapolis. I want to thank you for allowing me to be here just to speak with you briefly about a worthy cause, the Minnesota Humanities Commission. Wise Charter School has worked with the Minnesota Humanities Commission over the past 3 years through an implementation of the Cargill Core Knowledge Connection Grant. As a result, we have seen firsthand the quality of the training and workshops that the commission provides. Our teachers, when considering whether or not our school would use the core knowledge curriculum, they first put their hands up and said, this is so much to teach. how can we be expected to know all of this content? And with the help of the Humanities Commission, we've been able to break things down into compartmentalized pieces so that teachers cannot be afraid to share what they don't know. They come forward and they're able to participate in on-site workshops both at our school and at the Humanities Commission that help them to gain the knowledge that will be necessary to teach the children. In this ever-increasing standards of accountability, we want to make sure that we are preparing our teachers and giving them the tools that they need to be successful. Just recently, the Humanities Commission really showed their flexibility in working with our staff because we do teach serve a very, very high-risk population of children. 90% of them qualify for free or reduced-price lunch. 99% of them are African-American children. My staff is racially balanced. Sometimes children come to school unmotivated, feeling as though they can't learn. We must increase the ability of the teacher's understanding of what the state has decided they should be teaching to the children. We ask them, please help us in looking at these standards and breaking them down into components that connect them with their cultural history and identity. They went into the community, the Humanities Commission did, and they identified several different people to come to the table to work with our children, to work with our staff, to prepare them to work with the children. We are learning about, in first grade, our teachers are responsible for teaching ancient Egypt and the earliest civilizations in the Americas, so the Mayas, Incas, and the Aztecs. Those are two very broad topics that they are required to teach, but we want to make sure that they don't just teach the basics, that they're able to step back a little bit and make some broader connections with the two civilizations themselves and to see how they may or may not have impacted the community today. I feel that there is no more worthy organization out there qualified at this point to offer professional development and training specifically related to content for Minnesota teachers. Thank you.
Are there questions for either of the people who have just testified? I also have another, are there any questions for either of these ladies? All right, if not, I have another person whose name is here, Mr. Kelleher or Patrick McCormick, one of them.
Madam Chair, they probably would follow up on my amendment.
So if you wish to offer an amendment now?
Yes. Why don't I offer the amendment and then their testimony will make more sense. All right. So, Madam Chair, I'd like to offer H1852A1.
Members, you should have this. And would you explain your amendment, Representative?
Thank you, Chair Sikora. This amendment would provide funding through the same appropriation to the Minnesota Historical Society, specifically to implement the Minnesota Academic Standards in History and Social Studies relating to Minnesota history, to provide professional development for teachers to teach the Minnesota history and integrate it into the content of American history. This professional development through the Minnesota Historical Society dollars would also implement the historical skills portion of the Applied Learning Standards and finally integrate the skills and content related to the standards in social studies with the skills and content related to our academic standards in both language arts and other content areas. That would be applicable.
All right, so this is essentially for Minnesota history standards for the most part?
I think the gentlemen who are here from the Minnesota Historical Society will address that.
All right, Mr. McCormick.
Madam Chair, my name is Patrick McCormick. I'm Deputy Director of the Minnesota Historical Society. The Historical Society is an educational organization. We serve several hundred thousand school kids who come to our historic sites and museums every year. And if you're up at the History Center today, you would hear the halls echoing with school kids who participate in a variety of educational programs. We also provide curricula and, in fact, have published this book on Minnesota history, and we have staff who do teacher training. And, frankly, we see it as part of our mission to be involved with both working with school kids to understand Minnesota history and national history, and in working with teachers to help train them and provide information on how to deal with Minnesota's social studies standards. With me is Tim Hoogland, who was locked in the room last year helping with Humanities Commission staff and Department of Education staff and a variety of educators, helping put together the social studies standards on Minnesota history. And he can tell you a little bit about some of the teacher training that we do.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
I'm sorry, would you say your name again, please?
My name is Tim Hoogland.
Hoogland?
H-O-O-G-L-A-N-D.
All right.
And, Madam
Chair. Mr. Hoogland, what room were you locked in last year?
There are these rooms over at the Department of Education, Madam Chair, where groups of people were sequestered as the social studies standards in a more serious way. As an introduction, my official title at the Historical Society is I'm the Institutional Outreach Programs Coordinator, which means that my basic job is to provide professional development to and services to school kids and teachers from grade 6 through graduate school. And I also am an instructor in the history department at the University of Minnesota, which is how I ended up in this work to begin with. And along with Matt Brandt from the Humanities Commission, I was one of the two consultants who were brought into the process of developing the history standards as they went through that process last year. And we were both part of the final group of people who drafted the compromise version of the standards that ultimately was passed. And that experience really brought both organizations into a deep relationship with those standards. And as Mr. Romanstein mentioned, there is a lot to do in terms of providing professional development to teachers who need to put these in place. And the Historical Society has, as you see in the amendment, a particular niche specifically related to Minnesota history. And we have had, ever since the first edition of Northern Lights was published 10-12 years ago, an in-place network of teachers that we provide yearly professional development to. The new standards were actually the first time that requirements for the teaching of Minnesota history were put into standards. Before, it had been done by tradition on a district-to-district basis, but now these are a specific requirement, and we're finding more and new districts who haven't taught this material directly coming to us and responding to the standards. So we want to be in a position to service them. And you also see that what we're also experiencing, in part because it was partly my responsibility to deal with a lot of the American history standards that came through the process of the standards draft development process, is that Minnesota history doesn't exist in a fishbowl. That Minnesota history is American history. If you were here several weeks ago when the Historical Society had its day on the Capitol and you see the Gettysburg flag outside the House chamber, that's American history on your doorstep. And we want to make sure that we're in a position, working with our network of the University of Minnesota campuses, the state universities that we already work with through programs like the National History Day program, which I supervise, that we have a very efficient and established network to reach out to Minnesota teachers in a broad way in the areas that we have a particular expertise.
All right. Are there any questions for Mr. Hoogland or Mr. McCormick? Apparently not. Are there any other questions about the amendment for the author of the amendment? Did the author of the bill wish to comment on the amendment?
No.
No? Okay. All right.
Madam Chair, we worked out an agreement.
You worked out an agreement. All right.
Madam Chair.
Representative Plimpton.
It's custom to say something. I'm trying to remain neutral. I'll leave it to the prerogative of the committee and what to do on this amendment. Both of these groups are fabulous at training teachers, and as a social studies teacher myself, I've used materials from both of these institutions. So that's all I'm going to say.
All right. Hearing no other questions, all those in favor of the amendment, please signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Amendment is adopted. All right, and now on to House File 1852. Are there any more questions, no comments. Are there any questions? Any further questions about the bill? If not, Representative Klensing, do you have any remarks?
Yeah, I just want to close by putting this type of resource for teachers into perspective. Teachers' schedules are a lot like the schedules of a legislator at the climax of the session where we're busy from 7 a.m. to 7 p.m., sometimes 10 p.m., and oftentimes a lot of that is relating directly with kids, and we're not sitting in a closed office somewhere preparing lessons for the next day. Sometimes we are, you know, grabbing into our summer preparation file where we had spent some time on a nice sunny day at our computer preparing for just the day where we needed to grab something good. An opportunity for teachers to go pick up some very specific content-based, standards-based lesson plans and kind of even revisit some of the stuff that they learned 10 years ago in college can be an excellent resource for teachers. It is an excellent resource for teachers, much like when legislators are busy all day while they have staff working on other things for them that in an office somewhere drafting legislation, etc. It's like the Humanities Commission is off drafting some great lesson plans and the Historical Society is off drafting some great lesson plans for teachers to use in the classroom because they don't always have that time to really come up with the five-star lesson plan every day. And so this really is an important resource that's going to directly affect kids. Oftentimes these are some of the most favorite lesson plans that kids get to have. And so I just wanted that to be kind of a closing statement as to why I'm kind of committed to this.
Thank you, Representative Klensing. And with that, House File 1852 will be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. And moving right along, Representative Heidgerken.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And at this time, I'd like to move House File 1279 for possible inclusion.
Go ahead, Representative.
Okay, and before that, I have an oral amendment. If you would take out the bill before I address the bill itself, we're going to basically make some significant changes to it. So, if you would, page 9, take out rather than and put in the word and.
You don't mean page 9. I think you mean.
I mean page 1, line 9. I'm sorry. Everybody has that? Pick out rather than and put and. And then on line 14, it says 15 members. Change that to 4 members.
4.
4. And in finance period, it stays the same, sentence, same line. 4 members shall include, on line 15, take be appointed by the commissioner out, shall include 2 independent members.
This is rather a significant
yes,
amendment.
Yes, it is. It's just a change of numbers, basically. 2 independent members.
Quite
sure.
From the House Education Finance Division stays the same, and 2 independent members from the Senate K-12 Education Budget Division. So it should read that whole sentence, a task force shall be comprised of 4 members of experts in school finance. 4 members shall include 2 independent members from the House Education Finance Division and 2 independent members from the Senate K-12 Education Budget Division. And to get it in place on page 2, line 4, just delete the last 4 or 5 words. Delete to a course-based system. And then we would have the bill in place. And the reason for the change, again, is because we will be having testimony from Representative Roan had his bill up here. Some of the suburban coalition will be in favor of this, these changes as well, as will be the basically, I think just about, I don't see any resistance on the bill as it is. But with that said, Madam Chair, the bill basically touches upon declining enrollment. And the court-based finance system we're looking at addresses that situation. We had a bill last week that dealt with suburban equity. And this one here addresses an issue that we have looked at different ways of funding education, and we have had many different changes made to the Wendy Anderson miracle that we had a number of years ago, and since then many components have been added and dropped, etc. We have seen the governor propose the changing of the per pupil weight, the delinquent of sparsity, the delinquent of this, etc., etc. This is just another way of looking at fair and equitable way of funding, or looking at funding our school children. And that's why the movement was towards, I know that Mr. Strom and Mr. Kroll perhaps may not like this idea, but I think it's a fair way of doing it, is trying to get the politicians out of it, get the commissioner out of it, get the governor out of it, get both sides out, get rural out, get a metro out, get the suburban out, and we're looking at impartiality. With that said, I'm going to call upon, we have Radeline Dell.
Representative Heidgerken, let's first do your amendment. Let's make sure we have your amendment straight. Mr. Strom, did you get the amendment?
Yeah, I believe so, Madam Chair.
Okay, would you read that back to us, please?
Madam Chair, members, page 1, line 9, delete rather than and insert and. Page 1, line 14, delete 15 and insert 4. Page 1, line 14, delete 5 and insert 4. Delete the each at the end of the sentence. Page 1, line 15, after shall, delete the appointed by the commissioner, comma, the chair of, and insert include two independent members from the. Page 1, line 16, after the and, delete the chair of, and insert two independent members from. And page 2, line 4, after system, delete the rest of the sentence.
Do you have a question, Representative Erickson, before we vote?
Yeah, thank you, Chair Sikora. Representative Heidgerken, why do we need to put a task force that will consist of our paid nonpartisan staff in statute?
The intent of it was, thank you, Madam Chair. The intent, I had 15 members and there was going to be a fiscal cost in this, and this would change it dramatically. And I'm trying to get it away from where it was set up when we have different departments coming in. And what we're going to basically do is we probably would have ended up with the same argumentation of everybody trying to protect their own their turf. So what I'm looking at is establishing a independent task force.
Well, Madam Chair and Representative Heidgerken, I think we could request this. Thank you, Madam Chair. We could request staff to do this during the interim.
And that's what I'm doing.
Because they always, but I mean, we don't have to put this in law.
I think we do.
Okay.
And I think it should be called a working group rather than a task force.
Absolutely.
Because that's what it will be, is a working group.
Right.
So that means everything in this changes. Quite honestly, Representative Heidgerken, this is a lot of change. You told me you had a number change.
Well, it's basically a number. When you look at it, the only words that doesn't refer to a number, Madam Chair, is include. I used to teach English, I'm in Spanish here, but anyway, with that in mind, I'd like to bring my testifiers up. They come in from.
Chair, I have another question about the amendments.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Heidgerken, in Subdivision 3, consultant. So now we have the commissioner contracted with a private vendor to help these experts, our two gentlemen plus two from the Senate, with technical expertise. I'm just a little befuddled here.
Well, if there would be...
Representative Heidgerken, I have an idea here. This is kind of difficult. work with. We are going to have another hearing on Thursday to pick up all the little last-minute stuff that keeps rolling in.
Mm-hmm.
Why don't you clean this up and come back Thursday?
Okay, Madam Chair, I have the superintendent from Renville that called
right.
me from the outside. I'd like to at least have the hearing set aside, clean up the little language that Representative Erickson may want to make the changes, no problem. Okay?
So let's just not deal with the amendment at this
right,
point in
right.
time. Let's
okay.
have your testifier come up.
Okay. I've got three testifiers. I'll call them up one time. Brad Lundell wishes to speak on its behalf, as does Renee Harshbarg, and as does Doug Conway. So.
Mr. Lundell.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Brad Lundell, Schools for Equity and Education. I think this is a very important bill that we need to discuss, we need to look at. I think I don't represent a lot of very small school districts, but I do represent some. And I also represent a lot of districts that are undergoing declining enrollment right now. And I think one of the things that this approach really looks at providing a full range of opportunities to kids in schools regardless of what size and whether or not they're declining. I think that the governor's task force kind of sidles up to this in their talk about the kinds of categorical programs that need to be in place. And I think that what Representative Heidgerken is doing here is taking that a step further in trying to really flesh out what the governor's talking about or the governor's task force is talking about in terms of a kind of a sparsity or, and I don't want to say minimum program because of the connotation of that, I mean a program that will provide opportunities for all kids to reach the state standards. I think we're working in Schools for Equity and Education on a standards-based model. And I think that this dovetails nicely with what we're trying to do. We need to provide opportunities for all kids in the state. We need to find out what those opportunities need to entail in terms of program offerings, and I think that Representative Heidgerken is on the right track here.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Lundell. Sir, would you please introduce yourself?
Doug Conboy, Superintendent, Renville County West Schools,
Madam
Chairman and Committee.
Welcome.
I'd just like to speak in favor of this bill from a finance standpoint. When you are in a school district that is in enrollment decline and you lose money for every student that you lose, when you graduate 75 kids and you've got 50 kids coming in kindergarten and those kind of numbers on a yearly basis, you lose more funding than you can trim in your budgets. Now, if you just look at funding in my school district, if I lose 6 students, I should lay off a teacher because everything else has already been cut. To have this type of funding as a section, for a section of students rather than for an individual student, we would be allowed to stay in business. It's getting to that point, and I just can't emphasize that point strongly enough. We really need to look at how we're funding schools and what the inequities are because we're creating a two-caste system here. Thank you.
Madam Chair and members, Renee Hasbargen, Minnesota Rural.
Welcome, Ms. Hasbargen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would just add to what the two previous speakers have said. First of all, when the governor's task force did their work last spring, they never really got to the issue of scale. They talked about what should be an average program, but they looked at it in terms of an average size site, and it seems to me that they were around 500 to 600 students, and we know firsthand that there are a number of sites that are not average in that respect in Minnesota. So what we need to do is take some of that work a step further and look at, so what happens when you have a smaller site based on sparsity, or, as I'd like to emphasize, aren't we having more and more small sites in the state as we move to more charter schools and as we move to high school reform that's going to even downsize the size of high schools? This is not a rural issue. This is an increasingly metro issue as well. And so I would urge you to have this study done next summer and take a look at it next year when you come back.
All right. Thank you very much, folks, for being brief and to the point. We do very much appreciate that. Representative Hyde Gerken, how about if we lay this over until Thursday?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And it's one that, if you look at the office assigned from people from represents in the suburban areas as well as from the rural areas, and it's one that touches it all very nearly, especially when you talk about declining enrollment. Thank you. Thank you, members.
Thank you. Let's move on to Representative Broad. And this is another one that is an informational. This is dealing with special education teacher licenses. Where is that? Representative Broad, where is your bill at the present time?
Madam Chair and Committee, it's actually on the General Register.
Oh, okay. Go ahead, Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. Essentially, the bill that I have, not quite before you, but the bill that I'm here to speak about, is in regards to special education variances that are provided. The Minnesota Board of Teaching, in statute and rule, is allowed to issue personnel variances. Currently, the board has issued waivers for special education licenses for one low-incidence region. We believe that this variance should be able to cross regions. I do have with me to discuss more specifics about the ideas behind this bill. Gary Needus, who is with the North Central Service Cooperative, who are a provider of these special education services.
All right. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Introduce yourself for the record.
My name is Gary Needus, and I am the Executive Director of the North Central Service Cooperative in Staples, Minnesota. And the North Central Service Cooperative is the host to two of the nine low-incidence grants that are given out every 3 years in the state of Minnesota. And we employ about 47 special educators to meet the needs of our member school districts and 101 school districts, serving about 100,000 students. What we find ourselves increasingly confronted with under the present Board of Teaching rule is the inability to transfer staff, these 47 staff members, across regional boundaries. And I'll bet if I asked any of the committee members here today if they could tell me where the governor's development regional boundaries are for low incidence, you'd have a hard time saying that we cannot transfer a special ed teacher from Long Prairie to Fergus Falls without going back to the Board of Teaching, submitting another request for a variance, and then waiting, as it happened this fall, 42 days for the board to act on that. During that time, it doesn't affect the service cooperative or the organization that has the grant at all. We still get paid. It only affects the district that's got the student that needs these services. And in this case, then, Fergus Falls lost 42 days of funding for the services that we provided for that student. What we do is we work together with the other grant holders in trying to keep the same adults with the same children, regardless of where the children move. And when they move across the boundary, then the present rule stands in our way. So if you would just join with Representative Broad in supporting this bill, be sure to use the extra 15 votes when it comes to the floor. We'd greatly appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Are there any questions for either of our testifiers, Gary Needus or Representative Broad? Hearing none, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And we appreciate the opportunity to hear what this was about.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I do appreciate the committee's time, and there were no questions on this bill at the last committee either, and I'm certainly hoping that we can move this common sense legislation forward on the floor as easily. Thank you.
Thank you. All right. Representative Hornstein. And this one also was heard in policy. And I will move House File 1769 before the committee to be held over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Representative Hornstein, I see you added some money to your bill in the interim.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair and members. House File 1769 was heard in education policy, and there were a number of questions about the cost of the study. Just to quickly review the bill, Madam Chair and members, this is a study to address questions around various tests that are required both at the federal, state, and local level. Directs the Office of Educational Accountability to assess what some of the pedagogical impacts of these tests are and that's laid out in the bill. The questions that came up at the policy committee were around the cost of the study and some of the process that's used with the Office of Education Accountability and the State Department of Education when directed by the legislature to do a study of this kind. So, Madam Chair and members, I was able to make a few inquiries to this effect, and I did have a conversation on Friday with Dr. Davison, the director of the Office of Education Accountability, and he said indeed a study like this would need a special allocation. He had said, indicated it would be between $100,000 and $150,000, so hence the my amendments asked for $125,000. I also did request and received the fiscal note, which was for a bit more money, which I'm not certainly not wedded to that. I made one final inquiry about studies and their cost as well, which was to Jim Noble, the legislative auditor. As you may recall, Madam Chair and members, the legislative auditor did a study about some of the testing costs. Again, we're not looking necessarily at all entirely at testing costs here, but some of the pedagogical impacts. So he was familiar with some of the challenges in the scope of a study like this, and he also seemed to indicate that that $100,000 to $150,000 level was consistent with what they had done last year. So we have a couple of different figures out there, but I just, again, this isn't a $1 million study. It's not a $10,000 study either. So I think we're more or less in the ballpark with both the fiscal note and the figures at the Office of Education Accountability. Again, they did not do, Madam Chair members, a real, it was more of a back of the neck, and there were no line-by-line item, budget that they had presented. I just described the bill and what the goals were, and so this is what he had indicated to me the cost would be. So I'd be happy to take any questions, but I thought, given the questions that the education policy members had, I wanted to get at least a range of estimate in terms of cost of this particular study.
Representative Hornstein, you do have an amendment here.
Yes, correct. I'd like to move the.
I would move amendment 1769A1.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair.
And you may address your amendment.
Okay, again, Madam Chair, this is a dollar figure that I gleaned from the Office of Education Accountability that would be the responsible entity who would prepare the study. So again, there's a fiscal note as well that is higher. At this point, my goal in doing this amendment, Madam Chair, was to at least give the committee and you a specific dollar amount. I'm not sure if that's the protocol to do that or just to have the fiscal note available. Whatever your preferred protocol would be on this, I would be happy to.
Representative Cleansing.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Hornstein, on page 2, lines 2 and 3, the OEA can, at its discretion, include additional areas for evaluation. Is it your intent that they would be, I guess, kept to those few that are listed, or that they would really just be able to add anything in?
Representative Hornstein.
Madam Chair and Representative Cleansing, I think that's a good observation, and I think that we want here between having some direction, but also letting the OEA also have some discretion in terms of how to do the study. I had indicated at the policy committee that I would like to keep this study as narrowly focused as possible because of the corollary issues related to testing, and you get into all kinds of questions about various, again, both federal, state, and local, broader education policies. I'd really like to keep that out. And one thought I had, Madam Chair and Representative Cleansing, was whether we would include this or not in you know, a one or two line amendment if this does move forward. I mean, it would be probably useful, again, a study of this importance that has the potential to maybe get out of hand a little would be, you know, I'd be very open to having the chairs of both the policy and the finance committee along, you know, with myself as the author and perhaps, you know, the DFL lead on one of the education committees to just act as sort of an informal oversight just to make sure to avoid that it gets too expansive and to make sure that we can at least maintain some level of accountability and control over this. It's just a thought because I think that is a danger. If you would like to delete that phrase, I'm certainly open to that as well.
Representative Plumsing.
And this, I'm just wondering how common it is for us in our, this is not the first time we've directed the OEA to do anything, and I'm wondering if it's just common practice for us to give them this language, or if this is kind of a first time that we've done this.
I would defer maybe to the
council. I would say we haven't done this terribly often. Representative, would that be Lisa? Ms. Larson, Mr. Strom, who might address this?
Chair Sikora, I'm referring specifically to saying at its discretion the OEA may go off on. Just, I'm wondering, because I understand what Representative Hornstein is saying about, you know, I mean, having been a sociology statistics major and doing research projects, sometimes when you get into it, you need to investigate another question you weren't planning on from the forefront. But, so I'm wondering if this is necessary or not is what I'm trying to ask.
Ms. Larson.
Madam Chair, members, Representative Plumsing, over the course of years when we've directed various entities, be it the Office of Educational Accountability, the Board of Teaching, or the Department to do studies, from time to time we have put language in there precisely for the reason that Representative Plumsing mentions, and that is in some cases it may not be possible to anticipate related or tangential questions that may, in fact, prove important to the discussion. So in the past, in my experience, it's been an effort to really allow questions that may be germane to the overall purpose of the study to be explored. There isn't a hard and fast rule about it, but this is not entirely unusual either.
So, Representative Plumsing, did you wish to delete that or leave it as it is?
I'd feel more comfortable if, and I defer to Representative Larson if this is not proper legal jargon, if on line three after evaluation we said that remained germane to the basic purpose of the evaluation.
Madam Chairman?
Yes.
May I speak to this?
Sure. Introduce yourself, please.
Trish Elson, Assistant Commissioner, Department of Ed. I know Dr. Davidson isn't able to be here today, but as a fellow researcher type, I would like to say that I think the language is helpful and that the scope of this project, he might find something, a little direction he needs to go in. I don't think you have to worry about it growing too much, though, with the due date of next January. He's not going to be able to add a whole lot of things in that time frame. So I think the language is sufficient and doesn't really need to be narrowed down too much.
All right. Thank you. I'm sorry, Representative Plumsing, I've forgotten your wording. I didn't write it down.
I was trying to rephrase, or actually directly rephrase, or say what Ms. Larson had said, and that is after evaluation, say that remains germane to the basic purpose of the evaluation or the original intent of the evaluation.
Okay. Do you want to make? Do you want to add that language?
I do. Thank you.
All right. Would you read that language back, Ms. Larson?
Madam Chair, members, on the document 05-2415, page 2, line 3, after the word evaluation, insert that are germane to the purpose of the evaluation.
All right, does everyone understand the amendment? All right, now we, at this point in time, we really should, we can pass this amendment and then go back and pass the A1 amendment, but we have two amendments before us, neither of which has been passed. So let's first take up Representative Klinzing, since it's the most recent one, and it's a verbal. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Amendment is adopted. Now we'll go back to A1, and that is the one that has the fiscal appropriation. Any further questions or comments about the A1 amendment? Hearing none. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? This amendment is also adopted. And is there any further discussion of House File 1769? Hearing none, it will be laid over for possible inclusion. Thank you, Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
We have a little more time in this room, so we will go on to Representative Dietrich.
Madam Chair, it's Madam Chair. It's interesting to know what you just added 9 words. That's about all I added last time in my bill.
Except yours were in 9 different places.
Madam Chair, in that light, is it in order for me to move that the size of this committee be changed to 3 members? Because that's the thing of the number.
I would guess Mr. Representative Heidgerken would like to reduce the size of the legislature a bit, too, proportionally, maybe. Representative Dietrich, I will move House File 1434 before the committee, and that it be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. And I do have an amendment. Would you like me to move that amendment now? Or
if that is the order in which you would like your bill, yes.
Yes, I would like to move Amendment A1.
Okay, I should move Amendment A1. Okay. And you may address your amendment, and then we'll vote on it.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. Amendment A1 would, on page 1, line 17, delete membership may. And then on page 1, it deletes lines 18 through 21 and inserts. Committee members must include school bus drivers and school district staff responsible for pupil transportation and may include local law enforcement officials, representatives from other local units of government, and parents.
All right.
I'm loving this.
I know, and I should be counting words, shouldn't I?
No, actually, yours is written.
Yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair, for pointing that out. I think that's a good distinction.
All right, all those in favor of A1, which will put the author's bill in the form that she wishes. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Amendment is adopted. Representative Dietrich, would you address the gist of your bill, please?
Yes, I will. First of all, I want to thank Chairwoman Sikora and the committee for hearing another transportation bill. I know that you have heard a couple at least and will continue to hear them, but the one thing that I would like to comment is that at least I think that demonstrates that there is a need to identify some of the transportation needs throughout the district, throughout the state. And more specifically, House File 1434 creates a process for a local school board, for local school districts to identify hazardous transportation conditions. And first of all, what this process would do is it would call for the creation of a pupil transportation safety committee comprised of those listed in the A1 amendment that I just identified. Secondly, what this bill does is it would allow a school district to levy locally for a part of the cost or the total cost, depending on the cost of the plan developed, for transporting students who currently walk or bike across busy or hazardous roads in order to get to school. A person in your position might be thinking, why is this happening? why is there a need to identify hazardous roads? Why do we have students crossing hazardous roads? Well, I have with me today Tom Heidemann, who is an Anoka Hennepin parent and school board member, who will give you the context as to why we even have that happening in our school districts throughout the state. Tom?
Yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee.
Mr. Heidemann, thank you.
Tom Heidemann, Anoka Hennepin School Board. As Representative Dietrich outlined, there is a need in the Anoka Hennepin School District. In 2002, as part of budget reductions, the busing that was not covered under state law, that being busing within 2 miles of a school, was basically transferred over to a fee-for-service for parents. We have not been able to repurchase those buses recently, and we still have basically a fee-for-service bus transportation system. And many of those students, there were a total of 17,000 students affected by that in Anoka Hennepin. 7,000 of those are affected by what we would consider to be seven or hazardous areas. Yesterday in the Senate testimony, we had the privilege to have the Andover mayor come in and talk. He wasn't able to make it today, but I would like to highlight some of the issues communities are facing in the area of transportation. It's putting a significant burden on cities to create walkable areas at a fairly significant cost to the cities, all the way from trail systems to walking bridges potentially across the major freeways. He talked about $150,000 being spent last year for trails in his fairly small city, and another $150,000 being spent this year. Now, Andover is one of only 13 communities served by the Anoka Hennepin School District. So communities are dealing with this, and it may not be the most efficient way to deal with this issue. In some instances, there are county roads that divide the school district, and there's actually no way for them to economically buy land and put in walking trails. So the communities are dealing with an issue. So we've come together, and this basic proposal is based on a framework of communities, local control, and accountability, coming together to determine on a local level what the best solution is. Continuing to build trails, build pedestrian bridges, or maybe the best low-cost approach is to provide a bus. The local control piece, as Representative Dietrich talked about, is basically the school board is to form a committee by resolution that includes law enforcement, city leaders, citizens, and school district safety director. The committee's charge is to determine the hazardous areas within the school district that require bus service. The committee provides recommendations to the school board for formal adoption, and the cost or a portion of the cost of the busing for hazardous areas would be levied locally. This is not unlike what we do in a lot of instances for things like health and safety, but that's done on a building level and not specifically for transportation. Another opportunity here is that a one-size-fits-all law that would maybe be put together may not catch all the uniquenesses of a community, and we'll be able to deal with those in committee in terms of what is hazardous and what law enforcement thinks is hazardous, what city thinks is hazardous, so, and as a general rule, what the community thinks is hazardous. The aspect of accountability that we've built into this is the committee is formed by formal resolution of the school board. The committee is required to hold public hearings. The committee would be required to provide a low-cost analysis for all hazardous busing areas. For instance, questions to be asked: is the busing the lowest-cost approach for the community? Is it cheaper to provide a pedestrian bridge, adult patrols, police escorts, walking trails, et cetera, et cetera? Will the solution fit within the community's long-term plan? And explore all options with law enforcement, cities, and counties. This particular proposal has a levy cap of 20%. Of the transportation revenue for a school district. If you recall, the current law that we have in place for transportation requires that school district transport kids that live beyond a 2 mile radius from the school, including private school or charter school students that attend schools within the school district boundary. There is no provision in law for hazardous areas. Prior to 1996, school districts did have the ability to levy for student transportation in the hazardous areas. Since that time, some districts have either discontinued the service or begun charging user fees. A result is more students are walking across highways, parents are driving to students' school, which also creates its own issues in the area of congestion and overcrowded parking lots for drop-off and pick-up, and additional traffic and already in our area overtaxed roadways. So there is a real need for this. Since this bill was brought before the committee, I think it was last year, since that time there's been a number of other school districts and representatives who have actually signed on their support for this bill as the busing issue becomes bigger and bigger across the state. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Did you have any other people to testify, Representative?
No.
All right. Are there questions? Are there questions for Mr. Heidemann? I had also the name of Chuck Holden here, but he's not here. Is that correct?
Chuck Holden is here. And
did he wish to comment, or is he here to answer questions?
Do you have any comments?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I appreciate the opportunity again. I was here earlier on Representative Hartman's bill, and I strongly believe this bill is more all-encompassing because, as I testified at that time, we have students kindergarten through 12th grade in Anoka-Hennepin that are at risk crossing hazardous roads, and this bill does address that. I'd also like to just briefly say that the safety committee concept is not new to Anoka-Hennepin. We've been doing this since 1990, and it does work. It involves parents and bus drivers and identifies all these hazardous areas. So we've been able to identify them, but we are charging parents in these areas, and that has resulted, I think I testified earlier, that we have 7,000 students either walking or parents carpooling and congesting our school parking lots, and they just aren't as safe as they had been prior to 2002. So with that, I'll just stand for any questions.
Representative Dennis.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess my question is, on page 2, lines 5 through 7, Representative Dietrich, you're talking about the Public Transportation Safety Committee has to hold one public meeting. I believe that all meetings of the Safety Committee are public meetings, and I'm wondering if you have a different meaning for that or a different type of format. I'm just wondering the intent of the one public. Every meeting they would have would be public meetings. So I was just wondering what your thought is there.
Demmer, I think you're referring to the public hearing that would be
Representative
Dietrich. I'm sorry. That would be required to be held before you lay out the whole transportation plan, which roads are hazardous, what means do you use to get kids to school in each at every school.
Madam Chair,
Representative Demmer.
So when you say one public meeting, you're actually talking about a public presentation as opposed to a meeting then type of thing. I mean, that's not, I just want to make sure I was understanding that. And then one other question, Madam Chair, if that's what, unless you want to respond to that. That
it would be a
Representative Dietrich.
Thank you. It would be formally called a public hearing. Okay. Where the public could come and bring in input after hearing the plan for their particular school.
Madam Chair, if I may, one more question.
Representative Demmer.
The other question I have is down in talking about the hazardous transportation levy, lines 16 through 19 roughly, and levy the amounts necessary to provide transportation service to students facing hazardous transportation conditions. Is there a definition of that, or how do you determine, you know, the students facing hazardous conditions? Are you talking a number of students? Are you talking about a number of roads? Is there any criteria for that?
That would probably be for Mr. Holden.
Yes, Madam Chair, Representative. That's the intent of the Safety Committee, and all those factors are currently listed in our policy. Could be the number of students at a particular bus stop, the topography, the speed limit in that area. any number of factors. Bus drivers can bring an issue if we think that something is perfectly safe and we look at it on a GIS map and locate a bus stop there, but then the driver actually drives there out, and because of the pine trees or the slope of the hill, or a parent with the same concern can register that concern, and we have a process meeting monthly in our case, but where they can bring those concerns, we can reevaluate that, actually go out and take a look and make changes to it. So it could be any number of things, even to the extent of police reports, because of criminal activity in an area can result in a change in bus stop locations and designation of hazardous roads.
Madam Chair, a concern that I would have, I guess,
Representative Demmer,
without some sort of parameters, it looks to me like districts would just levy 20% of their anticipated costs, because you could really define hazardous in many different ways. Hazardous to me is different than you and different to anybody else. I would be a little concerned about not having some sort of parameter around which to do that. Otherwise, any school district would come up with their definition of hazardous and levy 20% of their transportation costs, the way it looks to me. I agree with the premise upon this, which this is done. I think hazardous, I would submit probably a lot of school districts are doing this in some way, shape, or form, maybe without this kind of format. But I like the idea, Representative mm-hmm. Drake. I think a little tightening up in some of these areas would be good. But thank you for bringing this forward.
Representative Dabney.
Madam Chair, I want to return to the first issue that Representative Demmer brought up, page 2, line 6. And I'm wondering, Madam Chair, in your thinking, would it be best if we changed meeting to hearing? That seems to be in line with the author's intent. And if that seems wise, I would so move.
All right. That seems to be okay with the author. The word meeting on line 6, page 2, would be changed to hearing. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Amendment is adopted. All right. Any other discussion? Representative Bernardi.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I want to welcome the school district that I represent here today. I actually walked with students by university school home because of the hazardous conditions in that area, as you know. And I really like this bill. I think that it helps give parents a voice. Mm-hmm. Parents wanted a voice, and it helps give school districts a tool in which to help transport kids and keep them safe. And this is a huge issue in the metro area, especially because I have school districts that are highways that go through them, as well as school districts. Now 2 out of 4 our school districts charge for transportation because they just can't afford it. And so the families are picking up that cost, and anything to help our children and our families to keep them safe, I really appreciate you bringing this forward, Representative Dietrich.
Any further questions? If not, this will be laid over for possible inclusion. It's possible that it will have to go to transportation, but at this point, we aren't sure about that, so thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I wanted to move West Vermont. Actually, Representative Westrom's committee meets in here next. I was going to move him up, but now I don't see him. So that's the way it goes. So I think I think what we should do here is we will briefly recess. We reconstitute again up in 500 north or south, which is it? Well, we'll be upstairs in the top floor, 500-something. 500 north. And so we will take up the rest of this. You have a 10-minute break while we get organized upstairs. And then we will... We are only in recess. Thank you very much. This is a little room... which makes it very cozy, but, you know, the sound doesn't have much space to spread out, so we can really hear all the chatter out there. So we are going to move right along here. I'm hoping that we are going to begin around 3:30. Of course, that's a hope. Nothing guaranteed. So, Representative Rukavina, I will move House File 1599 before the committee. And we have a fiscal note, I see. A little more than that. All right, Representative Rukavina. I move House File 1599 before the committee with potential for laying it over to be included in the omnibus bill.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair and members. Let me tell you that this has been heard over in the Senate, and it's sitting over there, excuse me, and I have the finance and one of the Senator, Ron Vickers, will be with the Executive Director of the Range Association and Municipalities and Schools on the Run. Madam Chair and members, it's an idea to all out there. I realize the cost of it, so local property taxes, there's none of us like, levy increases. But we have a crisis. Since I got elected to the legislature on the Iron Range, I can't tell you, let's see, in my district alone, Gowabic consolidated, Aurora and White Lake have become the Saudi East. Power and Babbitt consolidated with St. Louis County Schools. Gilbert joined with Everett and some Everett Gilbert. Buell had just consolidated with Mount Iron when I got elected. All across the Iron Range, there's consolidation. In Virginia, we had a new school, or a school renovation, where the bond, I think the 2 or 3 year old bonds have been let to remodel one of the schools. And that school is closed. We got a school closing, I think Senator Vickers and the other. Almost every year we had schools closed on the Iron Range. And so we come forward with this idea, and I would share members, just to try to at least pay the cost, some of the costs. Hibbing, we looked at Hibbing. They've gone up anywhere from $100,000 to $120,000 a year for this. Active employees over the last several years. I think Mount Iron's view is $70,000. So we're talking about taking a teacher or two at least in those districts that are not only looking at rising healthcare costs, but also looking at declining enrollment and loss of state aid because of declining enrollment. So, and I'm sure I know it's expensive, and perhaps the committee has some suggestions to limit it maybe to declining enrollment or something like that. But we're just here to toss out an idea, and I don't know.
What do you mean, Representative Rukavina, limit it to declining enrollment?
The schools that are facing declining enrollment.
Okay. So schools with declining enrollment.
Well, that would bring that statewide number that shocked you as people.
Okay.
Down a little bit.
You know, I think, though, that even the bigger school districts in the metropolitan area are now beginning to face declining enrollment. The birth rates are down. I don't know what's wrong with everybody out there. They're just not having enough children to keep us.
Okay.
Representative, former Senator Dicklich, would you like to make some comments?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, just thank you for giving us the hearing. Once again, we bring the bill forward just to some hope that we can have some solution to what's happening. Rural Minnesota, using really a lot of economic recovery, we keep telling there is for every time we work, it's not theirs. And economics and enrollment go hand in hand. They've got declining enrollments, the formula hasn't been increased since 2002. The school districts, even the bigger school districts, 2,800, maybe the 2,700 students,
You lose 30, 40 students, and it's whatever times 6,200, or that number is now. And then on top of that, you get $100,000 on active employees, $100,000 on retired employees. And now they're looking at closing all the every day, or going back to just every other day kindergarten. We just, in an attempt to try to keep some of our academic programs active, this is one small way. You know, if you find a solution, perhaps if the school district has a 2 or 3 average of training enrollment, allow them to do it, have the commissioners certify it, make sure that there's not the benefits don't increase. And I can tell you, for the 14 school districts we represent up there, 12 of the school districts have over the past 2 years been negotiating reduced benefits. So their co-pays are going up, co-pay for doctor visits, the co-pays are increasing for prescription drugs, and actually a lot of the unions have discussed or have agreed to take a reduction in the amount of health care we receive. But we just asking for some relief and trying to figure out what's going to happen in areas where you have the planning on the economy really isn't getting up. There we go.
Madam Chair, I might point out that
Representative Bukovina.
In the bill, if you notice in on line 11, it is on the benefit level provided for this current school year. So, you know, if by some chance it isn't happening in previous school districts that health and benefits are increased, it wouldn't be covered. They wouldn't be able to do that because that was the intention of the language there. So
you're kind of protecting, in a sense, protecting the levy amount by saying you can't increase benefits.
Right. And then pay for it.
I understand. Okay. Representative Grotten.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Berkovina, I just want to compliment you for bringing up an issue that's come up quite a bit in this committee, and we're now, even though it's education committee, you're right, it takes money away from the students when we have all these high costs for the teachers and other employees' health care. And we do have an informational hearing, this is timely, in education policy next week on the health insurance for the teachers and others, and there's a variety of bills that are out there, including letting them buy into the state plan and or letting them form their own unit or whatever. And so clearly you've got your finger on a huge problem that we need to deal with, and so appreciate another alternative that we can look at.
Are there other questions? I think we pretty much get this issue. We just don't have a great solution.
Well, I'm not sure, but possibly this would be
the only problem is Representative Rukovina takes a good share of my levies target, or my potential levy target. That's the problem. You won't be able to have any other levies except health care at this rate.
Well, Madam Chair, that's why Mr. Dickens threw that idea out. They asked to come back, and you're right. The medical service and the third school, they can be getting money. They try out some kind of criteria, and Mr. Crow or Mr. Strong run the numbers that number can be reduced.
I don't know that either. It's pretty complicated when it all boils down to it. Representative Hyde-Gerken.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Rukovina. And I did offer an answer to your issue this morning with my ethanol plant up there in the range to create a few more jobs. But I would like to go one step further. I, for one, would be one to like to go back to the old one, tax reform bill, and undo it. Because I think that's created the problem that you have and that we have. We had a 32% general levy before then. And it's an issue that I think we have addressed within our committee here, and we looked at doing. I know there are some school districts that asked for a levy for severance. With that declining enrollment, I've got school districts that are cutting teachers with over 20 years' experience. And because of that, there's severance in there, and there used to be a severance levy as well. So there's a lot of different levies that we've looked at. The governor's proposal 2.7 is a start, and I, for one, I agree with you on the general concept. We need to do something. So I just want to do it.
Well, Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, and
Representative Rukovina.
You're very kind. You're trying to pick on me. He thinks I picked on his acting friend, and I didn't at all.
Representative Rukavina, I can't believe you didn't pick on somebody in tax committee. I've been there.
Madam Chair, Representative Eidrichen, you know, you just point out a costly expense that we have starting in 2002, that billion or close to $1 billion of school takeover. Mr. Crow is strong, but it's close to that annually. And right, that's a new expense that may have helped with our budget.
Thank you for that editorial, Representative Rukavina. Thank you, Senator Dicklich. We will
thank you, Madam Chair.
Lay this over, but very costly bill. Representative Zellers. Representative Zellers, I will move your House File 2340 before the committee with the possibility of it being laid over for inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Thank you, Mr. Farman. This is me. I'm being very brief. So you've got a long agenda. I have experts that know far more about the plans and what's been mentioned before me, so I will be very brief. And I will say that although Representative Recommended didn't pick on me, he did pick on one of my testifiers. So I think he's actually saying he didn't pick on me. He did pick on a lot of liberals. What we're offering you today, and again, I'm going to let some of our text procedure, but really this is going to be a collaboration, but also an integration of all services that we're looking to provide in our area. You notice that this is in Brooklyn Park, but it is in the Osso School District, of which I have asked the word about names of my school district is the Osso Maple Grove School District. After we go into a little bit of the detail, I think you really will see that this is can be a model for a lot of communities around, especially metropolitan areas, to not only have it in the same location, but a collaboration between any number of different agencies here that would help not only this again be located in Brooklyn Center, because this focus in Brooklyn Center, I apologize. But it will be a collaboration but also an integration of all these services to maximize the state dollars, which some of the budget kind of looking at here. Our new set, John Fredrickson, he is here from the Osso Maple Grove School District. I have a lot of other testifiers, Madam Chair, and members. Thank you for having me.
Thank you. Mr. Fredrickson.
Madam Chairperson Sikora, I'm John Fredrickson. I'm the Assistant Superintendent for Administration for the Osso Area Public Schools. And our district offices are located in Maple Grove, and we serve Brooklyn Park, portions of Brooklyn Center, all of Osseo, Maple Grove, Maple Grove, and the pieces of Plymouth, Pass, and Cork, and Gate. This is a vitally important bill for us to implement the plan for helping our children who are at risk, particularly our immigrant families. We are currently on preparing to do the groundbreaking for a facility that will serve adults and English language learners, adult basic education, general education degree, GED, and also adult diploma. But we're looking at a regional, or possibly a substantial state interest in that. We're serving basically the northwest quadrant of the Twin Cities metropolitan, a high portion of immigrant activities going in there. Basically serving the Anoka-Hennepin Public Schools, the Brooklyn Center Schools, the Robbinsdale Public Schools, the Osseo Public Schools, and Minneapolis Public Schools in that general area. So it's a large state interest project that's being led by the Northwest Family Services Collaborative. We're crucially interested in getting young people, particularly the very young, prepared to go to school, prepared to learn, whether it's reading, writing, mathematics, math. And this agency activity, cooperating and collaborating with them, will allow us to be able to make those actions more efficient and more effective in the educational arena, as well as in the regular arena of just getting people jobs and getting them integrated with society.
we've got some challenges that we're facing. We're facing a lot of young people that are immigrants, whether it's from Africa, from Europe, from Asia, from the Latino areas. These young people are having a difficult time acclimating. They don't know the behaviors. They don't know the cultural issues. Their families come in often not much more than the shirts off their backs. They're coming from refugee camps. And they're great people, but they need a little bit of a hand up for a moment to be able to fully integrate into American society. We're very convinced that the success of these young people will reduce educational costs in the long run and reduce the destruction for other children. And we have also with us two other testifiers, and I would allow them to introduce themselves.
Good afternoon. I'm Rena Kragness. I'm the mayor of Brooklyn Center and also the chair of a task force that's been working on this family center for the last 3 or 4 years. Every sector in our community, private, public, and business, is responding to the growing challenges facing the Northwest region of our area. The number of low-income immigrant and English as second language households in the region has been increasing dramatically over the past decade. Brooklyn Center alone, since the census in 2000, has over a 300% increase in immigrant families and non-English speaking families in our area. The households in this region have been increasing dramatically over the past decade. Our suburban communities face needs faced by many urban communities, but we have none of the human services infrastructure necessary to meet this need. As a community, we've taken it upon ourselves to respond as best we can. We have assessed the problem and formed a coalition of school, city, county, and nonprofit sector organizations committed to a new center. What we request of the state is to help with funding to complete the planning that will move this project from merely collated services to coordinated services designed to best meet the needs of the at-risk family, so that children are better prepared to learn when they enter local classrooms. Our partner organizations have already pledged considerable staff resources to this planning, along with the dollars to fund the first two phases of the planning, that being the needs assessment and the concept development. State funds will assist with the operational planning necessary to coordinate service delivery from the diverse groups of organizations. These operational plans will then allow us to complete the facility design work underway on this project. And the project is truly remarkable. I hope the state will support this endeavor and help us to get the finish line. A preliminary lead grant commitment worth hundreds of thousands of dollars is pending right now to start our capital fundraising for this project. I've been in local government for 11 years, and this collaboration is truly remarkable. I've never seen this in any other instance. At this time, I'd like to introduce Steve Klein from the Community Emergency Assistance Program.
Welcome, Mr. Klein, and thank you, Ms. Kragness.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'll attempt to be brief and reiterate the comments that were made by earlier presenters. My name is Stephen Klein. I'm the Executive Director of SEEP, and SEEP has been serving this community since 1970. We're a United Way affiliated agency, and we have evolved into a regional service provider serving Western, Ramsey County, all of Anoka County, and Northwest Hennepin County. In the last year, we provided services to 9,000 families from our two offices, one in Blaine in the Human Service Center and one in Brooklyn Park. In our Blaine office is located at the main entrance to the Anoka County Human Service Center, which is a co-located facility including state, county, and nonprofit providers. And the new family center, which we're talking about today, will be an evolution of that experience we have experienced in Blaine with the Human Service Center, and we'll be building on the successes that were demonstrated by that model. We want to move beyond co-location to coordination, with the idea being that we can provide services in a more effective and efficient manner for the families that we work with. If the state is interested in reducing families on public assistance and increasing the success of at-risk kids in school, we need to support innovative strategies to support frontline service providers. The clients that come to see, in the 6 years that I've been the director, we have seen a wide range of needs, housing, basic needs, medical services, employment, and other crisis situations. They are more at risk and they are more vulnerable, and the need for better coordination of services to address their wide range of needs is becoming more and more critical. We could do a better job of keeping families out of crisis with a more effective coordinated service delivery plan. The kids that we see and the families that we serve suffer greatly when the family is in crisis. Over half of the food that we provide from our food shelf goes to kids and families that are not able to provide for their own basic needs. The family-centered model will help us break that cycle and really make a long-term difference for these families. The Osseo School District has enabled us to work in partnership with them to tie together their building plans and their services in a co-located manner with the family center. In the 25 years I've been in human services, I have never seen the exemplary leadership from a school district that the Osseo School District has provided in creating the opportunity for this project to move forward. United Way has been at the table with us, helping us work on this model as they see it as very complementary to the goals that they've identified and also something that they believe can be replicated in other parts of the region. So I would very much encourage your committee to look for ways to help us continue the momentum of the project as we move forward with this project. Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir. Are there more people to testify? That was it? Okay. May I ask you, you keep referring to a grant program. What grant program are you referring to in here? Or are you looking to get a new grant kind of program set up here? School readiness planning grants, so you're initiating school readiness planning grants. Okay, I thought you were looking for something that already exists. Okay. Okay. Other questions from members? Oh, yes, I forgot. We do have someone who wants to speak in opposition to this, Dr. Ephraim.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Dr. Karen Ephraim. I'm a pediatrician, a mother of three, and a taxpayer here to just suggest some things that ought to be considered in light of this bill. The bill, although well-intentioned, isn't very specific. It doesn't define at risk. It doesn't emphasize academics, which if the school readiness program is to help children succeed in school, there ought to be some mention of academic readiness and not just cultural specificity and multiculturalism. And the other thing is that it's targeted toward immigrant children, then there really ought to be an emphasis on having the children learn English in the bill. And then in general, as I've said before several times to this committee, school readiness programs aren't terribly effective. The legislative auditor said evaluations of school readiness programs have not provided definitive evidence of its effects. The department has sometimes declared the school readiness has a positive impact without acknowledging other possible explanations for the results of its evaluations. And I'll just remind the committee of Georgia's efforts that spent $1.15 billion for universal pre-kindergarten efforts and saw no difference in test scores. And then I'll just say that our flexible system of preschool for those that want it and need it is fine, and our children outperform European universally preschool children on a test of reading, math, and science. And I have a handout here that shows some of those charts. And then there's also a chart that shows the vast rise in children involved in preschool over the time from about 1965 to the 80s, and NAEP scores staying essentially flat over that same time. So I would suggest that instead of emphasizing on early childhood programs, that the committee should spend its time and its money doing the strengthening the academics in K-12, because that seems to have a better result.
Hi, Dr. Effing, you mentioned Georgia.
Yes.
How many years have they had their preschool and, you know, follow-up testing going? How old is that program?
That's a good question, Madam Chair. It was a longitudinal study from 1997 to 1998 and reported in 1999. So they've had it at least that long.
So they've had it since 98 or 99?
97.
Okay. And the test scores now are not showing a difference.
Correct.
Is that what you're talking about? Okay. I remember when they started it, but it didn't seem like that was that long ago. I guess I'm getting old here. Okay.
That years have been around for a while, but, you know, and then we have Head Start that has been around for 40 years.
Oh, yes.
And hasn't shown any effort. I mean, there was just another study in 2003. That
said
that the readiness gap isn't any closer than it was when it started.
And it's
been $50
billion in
600
studies.
Are there further questions, Representative
Dagney? Yes, Madam Chair, Dr. Effing, you made a reference in this bill to multiculturalism. And I'm wondering if you could give me a line and page for that phrase in the bill.
This is, Madam Chair, Representative Dagney. It doesn't say multiple.
Thank you, Dr. Effing. Madam Chair, a follow-up question.
Representative.
Dr. Effing, you made a reference to European students comparing well against U.S. students. I'm wondering if you have any information on disaggregated data comparing these European students to communities of color, low-income students, special education students in the American United States or in Minnesota specifically?
Madam Chair, Representative Dabney, the data that I have is from the TIMSS comparison.
Madam Chair, if I can vote yes or no.
The TIMSS is the TIMSS. I don't believe that it's disaggregated.
Madam Chair, thank you. Dr. Effing.
Representative Dabney.
I think I've lost track of my last question. Maybe a mock. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. Any further questions? If not, Representative Sellers.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I promised 15 minutes. I'm 2 minutes over, so I have no closing time.
Thank you, Representative Sellers. This will be laid over for possible inclusion. Representative Sellers, are the people who are here today, are they aware that there was in the bonding bill some I think early childhood facilities dollars in the bonding bill that maybe they could apply for?
Madam Chair, members, yes. In fact, we are checking to make sure that it is not quote unquote spoken for already. There's no specifics in there for any specific. We're most definitely going to be applying for, I believe it could be up to $75,000 in the bonding bill as well.
Okay, thank you, sir.
Great, thank you very much. Thank you, members.
And your bill will be laid over.
Thank you.
Representative Solberg. We've been waiting very impatiently, Representative. Thank you for waiting.
Impatiently or patiently?
Patiently.
Okay, that's just fine. Madam Chair, first of all, thank you. And I think I'm bringing to you a bill that you might want to be considering. said so. So I have with me John Dean. Over the years,
I'll move your bill. Representative, excuse me.
Yeah.
I need to move your bill, House File 1927, be heard before the committee and laid over for possible inclusion. Go ahead, I'm sorry.
Madam Chair, over the years, IRRB from their two funds, the Environmental Attack and Environmental Protection Fund and the Northeast Fund, have helped school districts with bond issues. And we've allocated some different funds to different school districts. And we pay 80% of the bond proceeds, and they pay 20% after the referendum. Many of the school districts would like to be able to refinance those bonds, and one of the school districts, Grand Rapids, and they got some counsel from the bond council, and it says one of the sections, it was an oversight from the bill as we drafted in 1996, I believe, provides that the appropriation authorized terminates upon payment of the maturity of the last of these bonds. So if they refinance it, in effect, they have paid off the bond for the IRRB portion. So then the school district would be left with the whole rest of the bond issue with IRRB or the tax. Those two funds would not be able to participate in paying off those bonds. So they're not able to refinance them, obviously. And we do have an opportunity to save some money. I think I've explained the purpose of the bill, and Tom Deans will then be able to probably give some counsel on this.
A little thing on the technicalities here?
Mr. What, in 96, the legislature realized that it had made a mistake. It didn't have the language in that allows for the refunding of these bonds. So it put a section in the 96 bill that provided for that. Unfortunately, when they were putting together the conference committee report that year, they put a couple more sections in that, and it threw off the internal numbers. So you left out two school districts that were supposed to get picked up. It referred to sections 18 to 20, and it should have been 20 to 22. Then again, in 2000, they did more TAC 9 bonds for three more districts, and they forgot to put the refunding provisions in at all. And all this bill does is corrects that internal reference. You picked up the three districts that you intended to pick up in 1996, and you picked up the three districts that were up in 2000. That's all the bill does. It saves those districts money by allowing them to do refunding. And it saves the IRRR money, and there is no physical impact on the state.
Sure sounds good.
Well, Madam Chair, one of the things I'm a little concerned about is as interest rates are going up, I want these school districts to be able to have this bill passed in a timely fashion. I think it has zero controversy in it, and I want them to be able to refinance those bonds if the interest rates continue to climb and just gets hung up in something. We would indeed have no need to refinance them. My understanding is that over the length of the bonds, just the IRRB portion over the length of the 16 or 18 months is about $1 million. So there is some considerable saving in interest for both IRRB and the school district themselves. I think in Grand Rapids case, the IRRB portion was 80% of $5,600,000, but they passed a $35 million bonding proposal that they would like to be able to refinance. And of course, they won't without this legislation because they would end up paying off the whole, all of them.
Are there any questions on this? Representative Silver, do you want this to, you don't want this laid over for possible inclusion. You probably want this to go straight to the floor so you can do it sooner. Is that correct?
Chair, it would be probably good to have this as a dual route if you would like to have that. I'm serious on that. I would like to have it go forward if at all possible, because that would give the school districts the opportunity. But if you also would like to include that in the final negotiations, and I don't know what's happened in the Senate, and not been included, but I would like to have some conversation with the Senate to see if they can also move this along for a simple bill.
Is there any reason why we shouldn't say this?
Madam Chair, I think it's in the Senate Finance Committee tomorrow. I think
it's in
the
Senate Committee as well. Education Committee Division tomorrow. But the bill was not included in policy.
So I guess what I'm trying to determine from you, would you like us to lay it over and put it in this, in our omnibus bill? Is that what the Senate is doing?
I'm sure I don't know that for sure, in all honesty.
Okay.
Because that's through the policy committee inside. But if it's in the finance committee, I'd like to have a conversation to see if they can get the hold of this board as well. But not trying to pull any shenanigans here or anything else. But if we'd like to have some kind of a timely action on this, so that
you never know if a conference committee will be timely, do you?
No, I don't. I do want to give the school district the option of doing this.
My other question is, should this be going to taxes first?
I'm sure I asked that question, and I think it's always been in the school district that these bonds are in the school
district. It's not ever been before taxes. It doesn't have to go to taxes.
I got some corrections on that. Madam Chair, it's been in the tax in the previous year, but it's entirely school district bonding. It's not equalized, it's no state taxes or anything like that. But I can check with the chair of the tax committee to see if it needs to go to as well.
Okay, we'll check out where this should go next, and for the moment we'll lay it over for inclusion in our bill. How's that?
That's awesome.
Okay.
And I'm sure if I can have a conversation with you when I find out what's happening in the Senate.
Okay.
You want me to check with the tax committee as well, Mr. Dean?
I think Mr. Walsh can check with the tax committee, and I can't think where else it would have to go, but we'll check it out.
Hey, thank you. I appreciate very much the opportunity for you.
You bet. Thank you. All right. He is. A representative Western. Representative Western, did you? I will move House File 1242 before the committee to be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. And you have no amendments. Would you care to just address your bill?
I would, Madam Chair, Ms. Fong. Is this working?
Yes, it is.
House File 1242 is a provision that would help our school districts with technology access dollars for their infrastructure and that part of our school systems that is becoming so vital and has been vital, but certainly no less today than it has been in the past. This bill would mimic what the governor's proposal is doing. It, however, would ask for a little more into the area of technology access equity grants for our school districts. And I would just urge you to consider helping our school districts with costs. I believe in this bill it would be beyond $10, in excess of $10 per pupil that they spend for bringing the internet and other technological advances to the school district. And with that, I guess I'd stand for any questions, and I think Ms. Hasbargen from MREA has just a few comments as well.
Ms. Hasbargen.
Thank you.
Hello, my name is Pete Royer. I'm the director of the Little Crow Hotel Media Network. We serve 18 school districts in West Central Minnesota, from Hutchinson to Wilmer and Montevideo and so forth. We've been at this since about 1989, providing interactive television. And then we started providing internet access in the tag days. A little history, we had an ICD Aid and Levy book back in 1993, and TAG and TARP were funding our other services, and then you guys decided to take the ICD Aid and Levy away from us. And then the TARP got sunsetted, so for the last 2 years we've been kind of treading water. And this bill would do a good service to get some funding back into that area of telecommunications, which we've been really lacking. One of the things we've been doing in the last few years is we're doing a lot of things with cooperative and clusters to help bring down the cost of internet to the district. And that kind of started in the TARP days. My ITD cooperative basically is put together on the basis of that, the 18 districts that we had actually compromised three independent ITD cooperatives a long time ago. Now we have basically one ITD cooperative serving 18 school districts. We have 1,200 miles of fiber optic cable. What that really means more than anything is we're saving the state about $30,000 a month. $30,000 a month on internet costs based on what we used to do back in the TARP days of providing a T1 for a school district. We cooperatively purchase our internet as a group, and we have broadband access right now for those schools, and it's been a great service for us. It does cost money to get to that point, but it's been a good basis for us. Some of the things that's been happening, if you look at where we're going with all this, the internet's pretty much the basis for all our activities that we're doing. Right now we're doing payroll and finance on there. Human resources is put on there. When we report to the state, it's all done by the internet. Everybody that has a proposal always wants to base it on the internet, and they think it's this ubiquitous thing that disappears at the school district. And that's not the case. Since the funding's been cut, there's been many drastic decisions that have been made at the local front to how we're going to fund internet. We know we need it, so how we fund it. A lot of times that means not hiring a teacher or letting go a teacher in order to fund internet, and that's the honest truth. So what we see this bill is doing is kind of funding those things. Our current costs are $23 million in the state, and this bill funds $9 million of that. If it hadn't been for the federal E-rate program, we would have been belly up a long time ago. When I first started in ITV and back in 1989, Minnesota was kind of looked at as the state to go for technology. We're doing a very good job of including technology into our curriculum, bringing about things like interactive television. When we started TAG and TARP, again, I had somebody from Missouri say, boy, leave it to Minnesota to come up with a new idea and a new way to fund things, a new way to get things done. Well, we've been treading water for the last couple of years, and we can't see the future anymore. We're just been treading water to keep our mouth away from drowning.
Mr. Royer, yeah. This money was in our bill last year.
I appreciate that.
And for some reason, we just couldn't get that bill through conference committee.
We'd love to see it go forward. I don't take up too much time, but others say that everything we're doing in the future relies on more bandwidth and more internet, and we need that funding step.
Thank you, sir.
Madam Chairman, on behalf of the Minister of Rural Education Association, thank you, Representative Weston, for bringing this bill forward. Because, as he pointed out, what it does is give students with the highest cost internet access in their classroom, and that seems so important. We just want you to direct your thinking down the road just a little bit, because as we head into value-added testing, we are going to need, as Mr. Royer pointed out, more capacity out there to do online testing, and then we'll need a network to bring that data back so that we can really use it as an accountability reporting system in the state. And we were at a meeting recently where people from the metro area commented that we don't even have a network left in the metro area anymore, let alone a network left statewide. So that's the challenge ahead of us. We have a lot to do, and we were at a hearing the other night over in the Senate where they were talking about being online by 09 in terms of how we're going to have our testing program ready online, station card control. And having said that, we've got a lot of work to do by 09 in order to get that capacity built in. And the only thing I would add is this bill is great. Thank you. It could be better if we really incented districts to work together. And I know the governor has a piece in his
It's this bill that talks about administrative financial reorganization, but we think there should be more of a cluster approach, more of a group approach to getting telecommunications dollars out there most effectively. So we urge you to consider that as well.
Thank you. Thank you. Do you have anyone else?
I don't.
Mr. Knoll, did you wish to testify?
Sure.
Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. Peter Knoll, Minnesota Catholic Conference, I'm Education Director there. And I'll be very succinct in my comments. First of all, we support House File 1242. The bill ensures that all children, regardless of which school they attend, public, private, sectarian, that they'll have access to telecommunications and internet access to both be of assistance to the teachers and the students as well. I do recall that a few years back, that we had the technology access revenue program that was very beneficial to all schools. And we applaud the author for his efforts in trying to restore this type of program. In our opinion, this is kind of a matter of distributive justice in the sense that less affluent schools have difficulty doing this, as one of our earlier testifiers mentioned. It sometimes comes down to a matter of whether we have to cut a teacher or make a determination about having access to our students and teachers benefit from. This statewide telecommunications infrastructure will ensure that Minnesota remains innovator in K-12 technology. So I would urge your support. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Knoll. Are there any questions for any of the people testifying? Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a question for Representative Westrom. Representative Westrom, I was looking at the reimbursement rates, and I saw there was a difference between public and non-public schools, that public school reimbursement rate was 90% of the cost after the first $10, and non-public schools it was 90% of the cost after the first $5 per pupil. Is there a reason that there's a difference in those two calculations?
Representative Westrom.
Madam Chair, Representative Meslo, there's no scientific reason. Actually, I took a lot of the language out of the governor's suggestion and so on. It's a bit arbitrary, and there hasn't been a lot of thought put into that number being the right number. And Madam Chair,
Representative Westrom.
Ms. Hasbargen's comments from MREA that has been brought to my attention that perhaps there's a way to incent or ensure that there's the most efficiencies sought with this money by encouraging clustering, encouraging cooperation, so everybody doesn't do it alone, and maybe that would help in that the non-public arena as well, Representative Meslow, but. I'd certainly be a provision or a change to this that I would encourage you to consider and support as you're putting your omnibus bill together.
So this is designed, Representative Westrom, to encourage public and non-public to work together?
Well,
if they're in the same area?
Madam Chair, I believe that could be a possibility. If they're in the same area, telecommunications doesn't know if students are going over the Internet, they're using the Internet, and so I don't see why that couldn't work. If there's a non-public and a public nearby, for instance, Fergus Falls, Representative Nornes' area, there's a couple private schools up in that area. Alexandria's got some private schools. We've got them in the Twin Cities. I mean, they're in the same communities as our public schools.
Thank you, Representative. Are there any further questions? Seeing none, the bill will be laid over for possible inclusion. And thank you, all of you, Representative Westrom.
Thank you, Madam Chairman.
Thank you. Representative Brennan.
certainly.
Representative Sikora, would you care to move your bill?
I would, Madam Chair, thank you. I would like to House File 2334 be heard and later with the possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Okay, go ahead.
And this bill is just a very small bill. It's kind of very safe, the whole early childhood idea. And with the idea that we really want to concentrate on at-risk children. We aren't going to do a big universal program at this point, but if we could use some of the children who we find when they are screened or through whatever process, through doctor's recommendation or something like that, that they have particular issues that we might be able to help them with by having them in a pre-K program, that we would be able to do that. And what we do here is the kind of describe what an at-risk student might be. And as I've always said, I think at-risk doesn't mean just a student that's eligible for free and reduced lunch. And this just kind of defines different elements you might see that would describe an at-risk child. And then the commission of the ability to take applications and put out some grants for programs that would then be evaluated, and we would get a feeling of whether or not they were effective in doing a good job. We don't at this point have much around that has evaluated any of our programs. And I have with me Jackie Johnson, and we worked together on kind of how we would describe an at-risk child for a pilot program. And so we'll ask you to.
And Ms. Johnson, if you would state your name for the record.
My name is Jackie Johnson, and thank you for allowing me to speak today. I am currently the Community Education Director for both Fridley and Brooklyn Center School Districts. I'm also here today speaking on behalf of the Minnesota Community Education Association. And I want to begin by thanking Representative Sikora for her continued efforts on behalf of Minnesota's youngest children and their families. NCA supports all legislative efforts to increase funding spent to improve educational opportunities for preschool children and their families, and particularly at-risk children. Recognize this legislation as an acknowledgement of the quality of work because she talks about existing programs and helping those programs to move into this opportunity for evaluation. Especially that the work has been done through PCFE and Terrainus programs. We understand through this tough financial situation the state is in, which makes us even more grateful to Representative Sikora for introducing us to each other legislation during these hard times. And as always, NCA is ready to work and support all efforts in bettering young children and their families. I know that I work with Senator Sikora, on the language, and basically what we did was looked at the language. The at-risk criteria were defined under targeted services legislative language.
Representative Sikora.
I would just like to add that, you know, we always say children and their families, because I just don't think you can ever address small children without their families being a part of the program or part of the piece that you are using to address their issue. I think that's extremely important. So anything we do in this area can best include parents.
All right. Thank you very much. Any questions? Representative Pending.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This represents the part I'm looking at the establishment eligibility application process on page one, and there's a list of seven criteria, I guess. And I think maybe the testifier spoke to another place in statute where this might be defined, but it's a couple of them where, like, I'm looking at lines 14 and 15, live in a divorced or separated household. Not every kid that I know would be at risk just because they're out of a divorced household. So I'm wondering how this would work in terms of the program, how are these criteria going to be used? Because the other one I was looking at was number 16, line 16, 17, have experienced residential instability in the past 12 months.
Or homelessness.
And how that's going to be used or defined or applied. I live in a neighborhood which is got some pretty well-adjusted kids, but they move every 2 years because their dads are, or moms are in manager jobs that move them all over the place. So just wanted to, if you could go into a little bit more how this would be applied.
All right. Looking at lines 16 and 17, the way I would look at residential instability would be a family that was maybe moving from apartment to apartment constantly and wasn't staying in the same school district, and that children were always being transferred or just out of school for a month at a time if they were in school. So you'd kind of see that from maybe the older children in the family. It doesn't necessarily mean that all children from divorced or separated households at all. That wasn't the intent. It's just if you look at a combination of those factors. So let's say you have somebody who can't seem to keep an apartment for more than a month and is kicked out of an apartment almost every month. Or the mother is on drugs. Or, you know, if you look at the combination of factors, you will find what amounts to a child that could use a little help.
Madam Chair, Representative Sikora, I actually agree with that intent, and I understand your interpretation of it. I guess I'm looking for in the language of the bill how that, or maybe even some common practice where these particular, where this particular language is already used and applied in the way that you just described, that would provide some assurance that it would be applied the way it is intended, as opposed to it just could be interpreted so many different ways.
Ms. Larson, do you have any suggestions on the spot, or maybe we could go to Representative Heidgerken and then you could discuss it with Representative Hunting? Representative Heidgerken.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just basically a follow-up. I agree with Representative Kunsing where she's going. Look at line 12 and 13, 75%. Of the statewide median family income, that would include just about all my rural district. When I look at line 14 and 15, that's going to include about 50% of my district, about 50% of marriages end up divorced. When I look at line 16, especially the mobile society that we have, and I would like to see some more teeth in it. I would like to see unemployment as a factor, because that and there's other criteria I'd like to see added. I think the intent is good, but sometimes we have kids that qualify that perhaps should be qualifying, and there's some that really need it are not getting the monies. And so I worry about the way we're going on this. I would like to see a little bit more teeth into it. But I think it's a very good bill. I like the intent of the bill, but I'm hoping that you accomplish your intent. But by the criteria that you have, you might not be able to accomplish what you're trying to really accomplish, the at-risk students.
Representative Sikora or Ms. Johnson? Ms. Johnson.
Some of these criteria are in language, in the language that qualifies. I'm also the principal of the ALC program, the Alternative Schools, and so some of these criteria lie within that, not all of them. And I think the intent, the word that we use when you look at residential instability is really mobility rate, and so that might be a way we can language that. I do know that, and it's a really difficult statistic, but we do know that children that perform tend to have performance trouble in school often come from single-family households. That's not to say that single-family households equate problems in school, but we do know that that's a risk indicator. So what the language in the ALC bill or legislation says is that a student must qualify by one of these criteria. Maybe you want to say a student would qualify by two or more or something like that, so that you have what you're suggesting, Ms. Sikora, is that you have a multiplicity of these
risk factors. Representative Heidkirchen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, another criteria I'd like to see added are students that, and teachers know which students are picked upon. And I think those students are at risk the minute that happens. We saw what happened at Recorder, we saw what happened at Red Lake, and this might be an area in which I know as a former school teacher, I could pick out the kids in my classroom at the ninth grade level that were being picked upon. I could single them out because they've become shy, withdrawn. They sit in the corner, they're away from the rest of the student body. These are students that are very much at risk, and it happens at an earlier age. And too often we pass legislation, forget about these people, these students, and this would be this bill, if that could address that issue, would be a very, very, very good bill.
Representative Heidkirk, and the problem is we're looking at preschool, and we usually don't get to see, you know, that kind of behavior probably quite as much as you would with older children.
I think you already do notice that my wife Ann did daycare for about 23 years, and I can even pick out the kids already at that age. She'd have as many as 20 kids, and I could pick out the kids that already were destined for this at-risk behavior. I mean, they were already they were shy, withdrawn, and they're more easily to be picked upon. And it's very, I think the behavior is evident already at the age of 2 or 3. You can pick out students, potential students, that will be at risk.
Thank you very much. Representative Gaffney.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Coming off of Representative Heidkirchen's comments, I think he makes some good ones on how we are defining at-risk students and maybe, again, tying in some of Chair Sikora's comments, at-risk families, that you can't pull a three-year-old out of their family context. And I think of the information here, looking at reportedly flat test scores over the last 30 years, but not taking in the increase in family instability that we've seen in the last 30 years with the increase in the divorce rate, a much more dynamic economy that has meant much more in terms of job changes, periods of unemployment and instability for many families, increased immigration of non-English speaking families into the state, so on and so forth. Our society has not remained fixed in the last 30 years. Our kids really are facing and our families much greater instability and challenges. And so to simply say, well, it was like this 30 years ago and it's like this now, without looking at what families are like and what our society is like, is a pretty dubious conclusion based on insufficient data. But Representative Sikora, I wanted to go to the page 2, lines 28, the evaluation. And I just wanted to check the timeline on this. To understand that there would, this grant program would be intended to run for 2 years. Are we together here? Subdivision 3, page 2, lines 28 through 34.
Representative Sikora. Madam Chair, Representative Gaffney. I think it has to run at least 2 years. I mean, we're only funding 2 years at this point. I think it has to run at least 2 years if you're going to start to measure results. I mean, the idea of this is to, you know, find out if there are some things, because a lot of what we do now doesn't seem to have a great impact. And so we're looking for ideas that might make more of a difference in children in their lives before they get to an age where, you know, it's kind of all over when they hit 10 years old. I don't want to see that happen to children. And I just wanted to look beyond the poverty index, because that is definitely a factor, but there are just so many other kinds of issues that children have. I mean, there are children living out in areas that I come from, which doesn't have a lot of children in poverty, but it certainly has some children who aren't getting any time from their parents, who have behaviors that wouldn't be considered acceptable at all, who are just kind of bouncing around. And could use them, you know, just if you could just maybe have the help their parents to understand
you know, what those kids are looking for in their behaviors. But as a result of what's going on, a lot of the parents become frustrated too. And so the children don't get the care they need.
No, I'm sure it was important. Thank you. I value that you're running this at least 2 years. When other states come forward with longitudinal studies based on one-year data, I think it's a challenge to the definition of longitudinal, as well as a challenge to the definition of validity and effective use of resources or applicability of that research. And I think you make interesting comments, perhaps contrasting some of the challenges that some individuals face in your legislative district compared to mine, or your school district compared to mine. There are some challenges that cross economic, racial, and other boundaries that are real challenges for families and kids, and trying to do the right thing for them seems to me to need to be doing the right thing. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Dabney. Is there anyone in the audience that cares to testify for or against the bill? Dr. Epstein.
No, I didn't have fun.
Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee. My name is Dr. Karen Epstein. I'm here on behalf of EdWatch. And I just wanted to commend Representative Sikora for more specifically defining at risk, because I think that was a big problem with the other bill that you heard today. And I just wanted to mention that. But I also just wanted to say that I still have the same concerns about effectiveness and cost effectiveness of these programs in general. And I just wanted to read one quote for you from Darcy Olson, a policy analyst that has looked at a number of early childhood programs all across the country. And she said that some early interventions have had meaningful short-term effect on disadvantaged students, grade-level retention, and special education placement. However, the effects of early interventions routinely disappear after children leave the program. This phenomenon, known as fade-out, is important because it means that early schooling may be immaterial to a child's later school performance, or that the current school system, as structured, is unable to sustain those early gains. So I just want that to be considered, because we have to look at long-term use of resources and programs.
Thank you very much. Anyone else?
Madam Chair.
Representative.
Question for Dr. Eiffel. What university is Ms. Olson attached to?
She is
Dr. Eiffel.
Excuse me, Madam Chair and Representative Dabney. She is a policy analyst, formerly with the Cato Institute and now with the Goldwater Institute, and has analyzed programs in Arizona. She has examined Head Start. She has examined the Perry Preschool, Abbey, and a number of others.
Madam Chair.
Representative
Abney. Thank you. Was her study that you referenced here peer-reviewed and published in a peer-reviewed journal?
Dr. Efron.
Madam Chair and Representative Abney, it was a policy paper for a policy institute.
So that's a no.
Representative Abney.
So that's a no. Thank you.
Thank you very much. All right, thank you, Representative I'm sorry, Representative
Heidrick. Thank you, Madam Chairman. And as this legislation will support, I'm hoping that I would like to see one of the criteria in there that addresses the problem of the shy, withdrawn child, whether it be at the age of 3 or 4, and because that child will be picked upon and will be bullied. And it's something that we've talked about, bullying in school, et cetera, et cetera. And this is a chance to take care of the issue before it really gets to be an issue later in life. And the you can pick out the children at a very early age already that have those characteristics, and I think they should be part of this at-risk bill. Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Plensing, did you want to have any language to move, or you just want to do that as the bill moves forward?
I'm going to do this as the bill moves forward.
Very good. All right. Well, with that then, Representative Cora renews her motion that House File 1167 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Thank you, Representative Cora. The next bill is Representative Quincy, House File 832. Lindsay, would you care to move your bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. House File 832, considered by the committee for possible inclusion.
Very good. Go ahead.
832 is a bill to establish site-based management, school-site governance program. Is a little different and they're probably in your handout comparison of our current site-based decision-making model and the site school governance program. The emphasis of it comes from some districts who've implemented this kind of model in Seattle and also in Edmonton and Houston and parts of Chicago, Boston, and a few other districts, and found that some of the most successful school districts are the ones that have learned how to keep many of the important elements in balance, like giving teachers and principals the freedom to be entrepreneurs and identify and solve their own problems at the school site with their own unique solutions to what might be needed at that site. And then the district does a good job of collecting information about what's going on and only getting involved where necessary is determined by some contracts that they set up. So just to give a quick example and not rehash everything that we talked about, but in Boston, where they implemented some school-based management school sites, 11 of them in 94, and then did a study over a series of years on this site from 2001, they found that at those school sites, those schools had the highest daily school attendance, the fewest transfers out of school, the fewest percentage of students suspended, and are among the top performing schools on their standardized tests, and have the highest number of students on the waiting list. And these were not schools that were necessarily what we might consider the perfect students. And there's a whole book that gives examples like that. That's written by Dr. William Ochi, who was a professor of management at UCLA and did come and speak to a number of us at the Capital Forum series that was, and that he was partially sponsored by St. Paul Public School District, who is trying their hardest to implement many of his strategies. To participate in this particular program, I'll just go through the bill real briefly. The site-based decision-making team that would form, including a school principal or another set of people who would have general control or supervision of the school, at least one teacher, but could be more, at least one non-instructional staff person, at least one parent of a student enrolled in the school, or another community member. Then the school site would take a vote as to whether to have the site decision-making team present a plan to the board, and then the school site decision-making team that was formed would notify the school board of their intent to propose a plan. Then they would hold a public hearing to get some comments from the community on whether this is something the community is interested in and what they would like to see happen at the site. Then the school decision-making team would enter into discussions to come to a written agreement with the school board about what the responsibilities of the school site and the responsibilities of the school board would be under this arrangement. Then the school board members would vote on whether to authorize this agreement, and their decision as a school board would be final. So if the school board does not authorize this agreement, it would not go forward, but the site decision-making team would have had their plan heard, and the school board would then publish this decision into the public. And then if the school board did agree to continue and did agree to this performance making or this division of responsibilities, what would happen is that a performance agreement would be struck between the school board and the school site decision-making team to establish performance standards that the school site would have to meet in order to maintain its governance after 2 years. As part of that, this particular arrangement, as written in this law, would not actually affect any of the contracts. The site would still be subject to any school district employee contract agreement, so it doesn't necessarily interfere with the bargaining. However, should another bargaining negotiation happened for contracts during the existence of the site, there would be consideration taken for any needs that site might have in that bargaining process. And that's done anyway right now with different sites and districts. And then the termination of the site-based program would occur if the school site failed to meet performance agreements, and the school board would have to renew its contract and approval. So the school site would also make an annual report to the commissioner, and the commissioner is directed with evaluating the effectiveness of the program on January 1st, 2010. That's a summary of the process. And this is also being discussed right now in the Senate, so we have testifiers over there. And this has kind of been heard by a lot of you already, so we're not going to do any extra testimony. And just, I'm sure there's people who want to hold it, who might want to testify, and then I'm available for questions.
Okay, and it says here on the list that Jim Bartholomew from the Minnesota Business Partnership is also here if there are questions.
That's correct. Yes.
Very good. Welcome, Mr. Bartholomew. Are there any testifiers for or against the bill? Here they come.
Oh, I'm sorry. Rep. Demmer, a question before the
session?
For the author. Okay. Rep. Demmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess a quick question is, I noticed something on compensation pay. I can't remember. I think I read here. How would you envision this to affect teacher negotiations? Would there be any change at all with the school site having some authority with hiring and assigning a role in negotiating a change?
Yes, and funding.
That role with choosing, the bill does indicate, it has some language that indicates the site would get to select personnel, but it's only within the confines of the contract. So currently, there are districts that allow the principals to select sites or select personnel into the schools, and that possibly, but there are other districts that don't let that happen, and it'd be something that would probably be specified in the performance agreements, but also possibly negotiations or the contract. It's also something that could be considered in the contract when things are renegotiated, depending on the influence of the site on that process, and that just depends on who gets on with the negotiation or bargaining team. Also, a letter of understanding could be drafted with the administration to make concessions or kind of treat a site differently for under the contract. So that's usually something that's agreed upon between all parties involved.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Reverend Clinton. Just a couple of brief things. I think, as you know, I'm intrigued by the proposal and want to continue to watch this as it goes forward. I do want to express some concern on page 1, line 20, the 60%. I think given the possible significant changes in this, I fear that a 60% level of support from existing staff may be too low, that this is asking the staff to take on quite a responsibility and having the potential of a rump faction of 40% who are not comfortable or happy with this may inadvertently set a situation up for failure. And if folks are going to close their eyes, hold their nose, and jump in with both feet on something like this, I'd like to see it be as successful as possible. So I'd just offer that up. And then Representative Demmer touched on several of the concerns I had. I just also wanted to thank you, page 2, line 21. It's nice to see a Republican carrying a bill with the January 15th deadline in it.
Thank you. Lindsay, would you care to respond?
Yeah, I was surprised at that. Actually, it said 51, and I thought that was too low. So I proposed 70. I'm talking to the other teachers and working with this line. Actually, teachers are pretty active in that. They suggested 60, so I guess we're just all still debating that one. Subject to discussion.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Dean, you could state your name. Oh, Mr. Arnson.
Madam Chair, members, my name is Roger Arnson. I represent the Minnesota Association of Secondary School Principals, the Elementary School Principals Associations, and technically, I'm the executive director of the Minneapolis Principal Forum and St. Paul Principal Association. I want to start out, and Representative Plenting is right, we did do quite a bit of discussing of this in the full committee. But I want to start out by saying something that I think is real important, and that's that you can be a strong proponent of site-based management. And with all of the positive effects that it has that Representative Plenting described at the beginning of her presentation, and be against this proposal. Minnesota law currently has a very effective structure for the involvement in site-based management, and it has a considerable amount of check and balance in it. All of the provisions that are proposed in this bill currently can be done under our statutes. What this is, and it's somewhat hard to know what some of the motivation of it is, but what this does is it changes the balance in making the decision and what powers are actually going to go to the site. A couple of things that concern us as well, and in particular in Minneapolis, because we've had some rubs with the teacher union there, is the Minneapolis principals are very concerned let me step back for 1 second. I've been sitting in the back of the room for a moment looking at a different version of 832. This proposal morphs a few times. We have the bill here in front of us. We'll talk about this, but I was given an amendment as well that's been offered in the Senate that's substantially different than this. And so we get a bit of a moving target with this from time to time, and appreciate that we're working back on 832. The key portion of this bill has to do with the selection of staff. Who gets to select the staff at the site? And it seems to me that we kind of hear it both ways. I mean, on one hand, we say that we want the site team to have a significant amount of discretion in picking the principal and the staff. But on the other hand, we're going to put language in that says we will keep all of those collectively bargained site rights into positions that currently exist. That's the Representative Demers bill, where we said we'd like to stop some of that from happening so that we'd have some discretion about who's going to be in the sites. But this says those collectively bargained provisions will continue to prevail. And for those of you that were in the full committee, that was integral to Representative Peterson saying that she would support the bill. So I think that you need to clear that up if you're going to proceed on this. Obviously, we think the St. Paul model works better. And like I say, in St. Paul, the sites, which are made up of parents and teachers and principals and other staff, they actually interview principal candidates for selection into the buildings. Every principal in a St. Paul school was interviewed by a site team. They pick three names. Those names go off to the superintendent, and she ultimately makes the decision. That model works very well for St. Paul. When you hear from the business partnership folks that testified in the full committee, they say, we really like what St. Paul's doing. That's not what this bill does. This bill says not that Superintendent Hardy would make that decision, but that the teachers or the site council would make that decision. Then we get into a problematic part of that. St. Paul has approximately 120 school principals, and Minneapolis has 125. Assume that five sites didn't pick those principals to be their principal. Where do they go? Does that mean we lay them off? Are they no longer employed by the district? You know, are we undoing their continuing contract rights as a result of that? I mean, what happens with them? One of the questions that we raised before, rather, not all facetiously, but what if Representative Demmer is the principal in one school, and another school says, we want Representative Denver to be our principal. Does he have to go from within the school district? I mean, how do we manage those things? There's a lot here that isn't worked out. And let me give you an alternative. And it's something that we discussed and we've discussed with some members, because obviously it is a good idea to do everything that we can to encourage site-based management. With one caveat, the thing that makes site-based management work is the achievement agreement. Former Senator Brandel testified on the voucher bill last week, and he talked about that site-based management standing alone has a minimal or marginal effect on student achievement. It has to be connected with a strong achievement agreement, and there's some discussion about that in here as well. But that's where the focus would be, not who the employees should be at the site, not whether we can fire the principal. So we have to have that integrated program in this. There are some bills that have been floated around to say, let's provide grants for people who can create creative achievement agreements. And we don't have to do all of this PELRA and labor piece. The other thing is, if folks are having trouble under the current law forming these site councils, and I don't think that's the case. I don't think we haven't heard any evidence that that's the case. And current law requires denials of these site-based team requests to be reported to the commissioner, and the data that we've received is that there have been none. Okay, but if people are having trouble buying into this, then let's create a grant program, and let's try to replicate what we're doing in St. Paul. It's been a collaborative model with principals, with parents, with teachers, with the school board. And also, let's provide some incentives for people to learn how to do this as well. I'd like to see us come together on some of those things, rather than having to be real negative about this proposal. We are very concerned that my school principals are very, very concerned about this model, and we think it ought to be rejected. Madam Chair, I'd answer any questions about it.
Any questions for Mr. Arson, or should we go to Mr. Dean?
Madam Chair, I'm reading from the Council Board Association, and I'll try to be brief. We think the present law is a collaborative system where the two parties get together and they decide how this is going to work. We don't believe that this model is a collaborative system. We think it has the cart before the horse. We also think that you write into the law lots of the things that you would expect the people to be working out. The law says that the site has the control and responsibilities of the school board, and it says that it retains control of the revenue and determines its use. But then it goes on to talk about that we're going to negotiate how that works. Well, I don't know how we negotiate it when the legislature's already determined that's the way it works. This provision provides that all the revenue goes to the site, no matter whether they want all the revenue or not. Under the existing law, the site program, that's one of the things they work out.
Do they want all the money to go to the site, or do they want some of the money to stay back at the office if, for instance, they're going to be providing those services to the site? You're going to have a business manager, or is the site just going to do its reporting directly to the state? What are you going to do if you have a very senior site and all the money they get is all the money they get, and if they have to, then they're going to have to lay off teachers to fall within their budget because they're not going to have as much money as a site that has junior teachers who generally under the existing salary structure get paid less. We don't think that the employee language in here is drafted works. And I guess we just think that this proposal is too prescriptive a model. We think that the existing system is a collaborative model. There have never been any reports to the state that says that one of these has been turned down by a school board.
Right, thank you very much. Representative Clinton. Questions? Nobody on the list. Okay, Representative Demers.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just as for Mr. Anderson or Mr. Deans, I do have concerns about this, but, you know, in this day with Representative Clinton and others, the school board does have the ultimate authority to say yes or no to this deal. Now, what that means to me is that in putting this together, yes, the site serves no excuse of their way to do this. They hold a hearing. They do some things. But they're going to be having to work with the school board all along the way in order to craft something that's going to work and accepted by the school board. So, in my way of thinking, it's not going to be the school board's totally separate from this, and at the very end, they're going to read a document, yes or no. To me, it's going to be kind of a collaborative effort in order to try to get so that it is going to be addressed as far as the site is concerned. And what that means to me is that there'll be some negotiation and lots of work being done to get the kind of details that you talked about and the things that I think about hammered out. In fact, my estimation would be is that they would indeed, the school would be talking with the school board association, with the principal association, because the principal's going to be weighing in. And I have a hunch they'll get some of these things taken care of. And, you know, I guess, why do you not think, I don't see this as real prescriptive, quite frankly, the process and how they end up is, but again, the school board has ultimate authority, and I'm curious as to how you think maybe these things would not be worked out ahead of time before a school board would say yes.
Mr. Anderson.
Let me say one thing that that needs to get worked out in the bill in the form that it's in. Honestly, we've seen some other amendments that are significantly different as well. There was a question that was asked in the full committee, and it's a very good one. Is this an alternative site-based management program? Could we still use existing law and enter into an agreement where we gave some of the powers to the site and not some? Okay, or does this become the only model? And it appears to us that this is an alternative model. And to the extent that it's an alternative and it's discretionary with the board, then that raises, you know, comfort levels immensely, and that we would continue to be able to access the current law and the current existing model. I think that's really important because I don't think we should change what St. Paul's doing with this bill. So that's the first part of it. And I think what you're saying is good advice, you know, for those of us on this side that get nervous about these things, and that's that it is appropriate to expect people will use good faith and exercise good judgment, you know, and act appropriately. Sometimes as lawyers, our job is to, you know, say assume everything goes wrong and that everybody is bad, you know, and that does happen from time to time. But then we do have to look at the protections in the statute to make sure if there is an abuse, you know, how do we handle it? So, but I think your comments are well taken. But I do think it's important that we have some clarity that there's two systems that are being proposed under 832. The model that's being offered in the Senate doesn't have that. It's a little different.
And
Mr. Dean.
Madam Chair, Representative Demmer, just for an example, if you look on page 2, lines 14 and 15, it says the team has the control and responsibility of the school board. Then you get down to lines 21 through 25, and it says they must enter into a written agreement describing the control and responsibilities of the Keene and the school board. The legislature already described them. That's the thing, you know, when you do these things, under the existing law, you say they can enter into an agreement and they should figure out how they're going to do this and to make it work. And you don't necessarily tell us what the answer is to every one of them. When you come to the fork in the road every time, you go right or you go left. You don't say, well, you have to go left at this fork. You let the parties determine that. And in this bill, it makes the decision for the parties.
Custom cleansing.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I think that just looking at the language that was just referenced by Mr. Deans, I think the operating words there are participating. Those participating in the program under this section and this law, because they're not participating until the school board members must vote to authorize the agreement. So all that would be worked out in that agreement, and that agreement is binding to those that are participating. I just want to also just talk about some of what's going on in the Senate and the other amendments that's in another body, and I'm not even sure what's happening over there. There are significant amendments being proposed, not unlike a lot of amendments and a lot of dialogue that went into this version of the bill. Not all were amendments. Some of it was just preliminary meetings with members of Education, Policies, and Finance Committees. And so this is something that is interesting to a lot of different legislators and policymakers in education right now. And I think that the fact that a lot of people are working on trying to make the language the best is really signifying how important this is and how good it can work. And I don't want to take anything away from Pat Harvey. She's a great superintendent in St. Paul, and things are working very well there in St. Paul. But a lot of the districts that have implemented this, it doesn't always work to have the superintendent do that, and that's why I think it's great that we could have a program where that's okay, but also have an opportunity where for the sites to work out an agreement with the district that they could do some selection from the site level of some leadership for their building. So I just wanted to point that out as something that came up. And the achievement agreement really is kind of that performance is kind of the key to this piece of legislation. And I'm really excited about that part of this bill. And I know Representative Dorn has a question.
Representative Dorn.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Flinzing, and to the testifiers, I'm still thinking we probably would need the bill moves forward to think about more clarification for the language that Mr. Deans pointed out. It does seem to me it says that before they're participating, they negotiate, but then elsewhere in the law it would say after they are a decision-making team that is participating, they would have all of the authority. It just still seems to me that there's an inconsistency there that should be checked. Staff has pointed out that we may have just changing on page 3. We should take a look at just what modifying phrase goes where. Page 3, starting with subdivision 4 on line 7, at the end of that sentence on line 9, I guess that was okay, the comma, consistent with current law and the collaborative bargaining agreement in effect. Then would we put a period after effect and start the new sentence with the school site decision-making team? At first, I was thinking it worked the other way, that we'd put the period after issues and have the consistent with current law. I think we should at least make clear what we are making consistent with current law and collective bargaining, and which applies to what. It doesn't work to me written the way it is, but I'm not sure what the intention was for or how it works. That would be another language area to look at. I don't know if Representative Clinton sees what I'm picking up from staff and the inconsistency there, the confusion.
Representative Clinton.
Madam Chair, Representative Zorn, this section was rewritten in education policy and really was an amendment of another member. So the intent is to not necessarily break collective bargaining agreements and to have the site working within those, within the district. So whatever achieves that intent, I'm okay with that language.
Staff is thinking that it works better if we did it with a period after issues, and then I can make that motion based on staff's advice, and think that we could visit with I think it was Representative Erickson
Peterson,
who worked on this, and so I'll move if that's okay, at least to get it in what staff thought was going to be. Page 3, line 9, we put a period after issues, and then it starts a new sentence with the other case, C, consistent with the current law. And I move that to hopefully get the bill in the shape that was intended. So,
okay, sorry, I was missed. Representative Dabney, could you, I'm going to have staff repeat it so we can, are you moving, making that motion?
Yes, madam.
Okay, Ms. Larson, could you run through it again, because I was otherwise preoccupied.
Madam Chair, members, on the document, on the first engrossment of House File 832, Representative Dorn raised the question about an amendment that Representative Peterson offered in the Policy Committee, and that question goes to the phrase that appears on page 3, beginning on line 9 and following, asking to ensure that the decisions affecting employees be consistent with current law and the collective bargaining agreement in effect. The question is whether it modifies the first part of what is a very long sentence or the second part, which is a second sentence. And my recollection, and I don't promise this is correct, is that the period should appear on page 3, line 9, after the word issues, and that consistent would begin the second part of that sentence. But again, I'm not absolutely certain about that.
Okay, so Representative Dorn moves that on page 3, line 9, we end other personal issues with a period, and consistent is capitalized. Representative Clinton, do you have any comment to that?
I'm fine with that.
Okay, so all in favor of that change, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Amendment carries. Representative Dorn.
Thank you, if I might. I don't know if I'm not reading it correctly. Does the bill specify the size of the team, or is it just that it's minimally a principal or other person, a teacher, a staff person, and a parent? Is it at least four and then any number above that, or is there some balance or proportionality, or am I just not sure that I'm seeing it there, what is a site team or what can be a site team?
Madam Chair, Representative Dorn, you're correct. It's a minimum standard.
And,
Representative Dorn.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And maybe any of the witnesses, I'm on page 2, and some of the funding issues were addressed. But after our discussion of how difficult it is to identify just who is at risk, and no one definition seems to always fit, I'm wondering about the language on 28 and 29 that the revenue is proportionately allocated. And I'm really just asking, is that the current practice with site-based management? Is that the current practice? Or do we leave some flexibility with school districts to make adjustments based on particular needs in sites that this bill would not allow? Are we locking them into something that's different? I'm just looking for background and understanding.
Reference funding.
Okay, I wasn't sure if the question was directed to the testifiers or myself. I'll comment, and then I'll let them make a comment, too. Right now, it is kind of determined. It really has negotiated locally, depending. And I've worked in a site-based decision-making schools that have had very different agreements with the districts. And under this bill, it does operate differently than the site-based decision-making laws, because under this site management, it would go to proportional distribution of funds to the district, so that they would have kind of their chunk of the pie to manage the resources as they saw fit for the site, which is one of the things that a lot of successful site-based management school districts have found to be one of the key ingredients.
Okay. Mr. Dean?
I'm sure the current statute says that revenue for a fiscal year that's received or receivable by the district shall be allocated to education sites based on the agreement between the school board and site team, and it remains allocated to that site until used by the site, and the site teams and the board can enter into an agreement that permits the district to provide services and retain the revenue required to pay for the services provided. That wouldn't be allowed under this.
Thank you, Madam.
Thank you. Representative Demmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's infringing in the cycle that I want to muck up your bill. But I do have a thought in listening to Mr. Dean, and I thought about this before, and never really crystallized. Page 2, lines 14 and 15, where it talks about the control and responsibilities of the school board. That is something that bothers me also, and I concur. How would you feel about if we just change that a little bit to say, like, for example, the control and responsibilities as agreed to by the school board, which may include such responsibilities, would that significantly alter what you're trying to accomplish? And I don't know if most states could respond if that would be helpful. If we get a little more comfort to me, and I don't know how you feel about that, and I don't know how you feel about it, so I'm going to offer a yes if you respond.
Madam Chair, Representative
Zimmer,
the intent is for those responsibilities to be negotiated and for that agreement then to be abided by. If that's what the language does, I'm okay with that. I'm okay with that language. Because I don't actually see a situation where the school board is going to have... because they're always going to remain that control and responsibility of vetoing and making sure the site meets the performance agreement, and that's the intent, and I wouldn't want this language to take that intent away from the school board powers.
Representative Socorro has just whispered across the room that we need to be out of this room by 4:30, and we do have another bill, so I'm not sure if we wanted to... Representative Socorro, do you want to have the other bill heard later, or do you want us to try to squeeze it in?
Well, you know, if you could squeeze it in, it would be nice. I don't think that one will take very long. Maybe I'm wrong.
Okay. Well, Representative Demmer, if you could conclude.
Well, that was my thoughts, those few words. I don't know if Ms. Larson or
if you
want to... I think that bothers me. That one clause in there taken by itself is quite prescriptive. And I think by making those slight changes, and if there's something I'm not missing, it's kind of a quick oral amendment that we can incorporate or something, or whatever we can do.
Well, Mr. Representative Demmer, maybe you could work with Representative Funding to work on that amendment.
We're laying it over. We're
laying it over.
We're laying it over.
So, any final comments? It sounds like there's a lot of working to be done in Detroit. Thank you very much.
Okay.
House File 832 will be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. And the last bill then is House File 1167. And Representative Abler was in and out, so I guess he asked if I would present the bill.
We can move along if we have to, can't we? Okay,
Representative Bradley, would you like to move the bill and talk about it?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll move House File 1167 and change the time. I will turn it over to the testifiers and let them go in the order in which they choose.
Thank you. My name is Eric Nessheim. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Literacy Council. The Literacy Council is a statewide nonprofit that supported and advocated for literacy for over 30 years. Our main focus is volunteer literacy and community programming, but we also have an adult literacy hotline for the state, and we offer a lot of infrastructure for adult literacy education programs. We really want to thank you for hearing us today, and I know you've heard a lot today, so we're glad that you've waited around to hear us. The House over the years has shown an overwhelming support for literacy, and we're very appreciative of that. And you've actually helped to make literacy in Minnesota one of the best programs in the nation, we believe. I'm sure that you sit here and throughout the days you listen to everybody that comes here and says that their program is the center of the universe, and unfortunately we're no different. I just have a few points actually to make though about literacy. So in my role as an educator, in the Senate hearing of this bill, we had a young man who is an adult basic education learner that had a real interesting testimony. It was very brief. He sat down and what he said was, I want to join the Marines. I've been studying at the Hub Center for the last few years. I need a diploma to join the Marines. If you don't fund this program, this is what I have. And he held up a blank sheet of paper. Okay. And it was quite effective, we all felt. But surely, without literacy, there is no job. Without literacy, a home is very difficult to find. Transportation is very difficult to maneuver. The family suffers. There's a greater chance of poverty, of incarceration. A simple health issue can turn into a crisis very easily. If someone does, by chance, get a job, there's often accidents in the workplace. If there's no books, no newspapers in the home, if a parent can't help with homework or read a story to a child, the chances are great that child is going to be disadvantaged, and I believe Representative Sikora made that point very eloquently earlier today. There's a great deal of hope, though, for people who do join our programs. They oftentimes have a better chance of getting a job that supports their family. They oftentimes will not fear what the next crisis will be, and there's no more anxiety around homework time. Just a couple of facts here. Adult literacy leads to greater job attainment and job retention. The lifetime earnings and economic self-sufficiency rates of those who have gone through our programs are markedly higher than those who need help or don't get help. The National Institute for Literacy in Washington has figures that indicate that a GED, a high school diploma, nearly doubles the probability of working and staying employed. Another impact is the impact on families. Both the United States Department of Education and the National Center for Family Literacy directly link literacy level of a parent with the literacy achievements of the child. Once again, most of our learners have children in the school districts in our towns. If the parent's not literate, chances are great the child will not be. Literacy helps new Americans participate more fully in their communities as voters and civically engaged citizens. It improves communication with healthcare providers, making it less expensive for our cities. And these are just a few of the impacts that ABE, Adult Basic Education, has on our individuals in our state. With just a few more resources, we can do a great deal to improve the lives of citizens in this state and make the state a better place. Over the past few years, we have seen a 36% increase in services. Well, at the same time, the reimbursement rate by contact hour has dropped by 33%. We stretched our programming as to the limits that we believe we can stretch it to, and now we're starting to experience waiting lists in cities across the state. We're asking in this bill for a 3% increase in resources dedicated to the adult basic education formula annually. This increase will go a long way to improving the lives of citizens in Minnesota, getting people to work, keeping their homes stable, keeping people out of poverty. Once again, thank you very much for your commitment and your time, and Vicki Ostrom will be talking about a few more of the items in the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Nass. Ms. Ostrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and House members. I am Vicki Ostrom, and I'm really hoping that you save the best for last. But I am the coordinator and instructor in the Adult Basic Education Program in Braham, Cambridge, Sandy, Mora, and Princeton. In our consortium, we serve about 380 adult learners a year. And one of the unique characteristics about our program is our partnership with the Cambridge campus of Anoka Ramsey Community College. The college actually provides facilities in Cambridge, and then we work with students who are making that transition from a GED or high school diploma into college-level courses. That's one of the hats I wear. One of the other hats I wear is serving as president of Literacy Minnesota this year. And so I'm really testifying with both of those hats on today. Adult basic education, as Eric said, is an extremely cost-effective and cost-efficient program. The average cost per AD learner is about $504. I'm here today in support of House File 1167, and this bill is supported by adult basic education professionals throughout the entire state through Literacy Minnesota. Adult basic education funding isn't any different than education funding for K-12, and that's very, very complex. And I just want to address one of the aspects of this bill related to funding. This section of the bill allows a small portion of ADE funds in one fiscal year to be carried over into 3 months in the next fiscal year. Due to legislative mandate, educational aides are distributed to programs in a system that allows 80% of the annual aid during the current program year, and then we're reimbursed for the 20% in the fall. This system, 80-20 reimbursement, which is called the revenue shift, was designed a number of years ago to solve budget problems in the state. But by state ADE law, the dilemma is there's no provision for carryover of ADE money. So in other words, 100% of our money needs to be spent by June 30th. So you can see there's a little bit of a budget dilemma here in that we're spending money that we don't have. Not very fiscally sound. And many ADE programs can borrow this money from their school district. They can float them alone until they get paid in the fall. But some school districts and community-based organizations, that doesn't happen. They don't have access to that money. And so they actually forfeit that 20%. In the current biennium, $217,000 was unspent by ADE programs in the allotted time frame. If adult basic education programs, specifically those that have that dilemma, could carry over that 20%, it would really make a significant impact for those programs and those learners. And House File 1167 would allow this short-term carryover. There are two other aspects in our bill that we're not going to talk about because they're also in Governor Pawlenty's budget proposal. So if you would support House File 1167, it would be greatly appreciated. And thanks.
Thank you, Ms. Ostrom. Any questions from members? Seeing and hearing none, Representative Greiland, will you renew your motion? Okay, we'll lay over House File 1167 for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. And this meeting. Oh, somebody would move the minutes, please. Representative Meslow, move the minutes. Okay, with that, members, this meeting is adjourned.